please.
Hi, everybody. We're live. So I fixed something today.
I mended something. I don't know if you'll get that reference. It's a Jeremy Clarkson thing.
Oh, okay. But
anyway, carry on. What did you fix?
It took 3 weeks, but I have fixed my stupid Dyson vacuum broken trigger.
I was not aware that you had a Dyson vacuum with a broken trigger.
Okay, so long story short, yes, I use Dyson vacuums. Of course I do. Years ago, when it came time to buy a new vacuum, I did all the research, and I looked at the specs, and I'm like, I got this giant upright Miele vacuum that has like massive suction power and is amazing to pull out all sorts of crap from rugs. But it's super heavy and corded, and therefore I hardly ever use it. And then, meanwhile, 1 year Tiff requested one of these little like cordless Dyson thingies, like the V7 or 8 or 9 or whatever it was back then.
Which, by the way, must have incredible profit margins because they are so expensive. I also have one.
Yes. Yes, they are. And
before we go any further, so we have one of the, not OG, but an older corded, you know, upright Dyson vacuum with the ball on the bottom. And I remember we got it at from like, I don't know, woot.com, you know, back when it was good or something like that. Or I forget where we got it, but it was considerably discounted. And I got to say, I'm not that impressed with it. So do you like the cordless one? Because the corded, I did not think was that great.
I also had an upright one and I didn't like it and ditched it. But the cordless one, I feel like comes closer to justifying its insane price.
Yeah, okay, so I actually had that exact same heavily discounted Dyson stand-up ball one from a million years ago. It eventually broke in some way that I didn't feel that it was worth fixing. Although I actually did fix it a couple of times along the way there, because one of the positives about Dyson is that while they're not the best built things in the world, there are lots of service parts available for not that, and they aren't that hard to get, and they aren't that expensive, so that you can at least service them to some degree, which is nice. But anyway, so. The problem is, so I had this beautiful this big upright heavy thing, and it was, we just never used it. Like, I would use it occasionally, but like, you know, no one else in the house would ever use it. Everyone hated it, and I would never like bring it upstairs. It's too heavy and all this stuff. So anyway, 1 year Tiff requested one of the Dyson V whatever's for Christmas, and I got one, and everyone loved it, and that's all we ever used from that point forward. And the Miele still sits in the closet and never gets used. So anyway, we've had when we got the beach house, we got only the Dyson for there, and we never looked back. Problem is, they are built crappily in certain ways, and one of those ways is the little red trigger that you squeeze. If you search the internet for Dyson broken triggers, you'll see these are horribly designed. With these little, all the pressure to hold that trigger against the battery terminals is this little thin piece of plastic that cracks very easily.
One thing about those triggers, though, one thing they did get right about the triggers is the effort to pull the trigger is very, very low, because it would get fatiguing if you were holding it and you had to like hold the trigger and it was like fighting you the whole time. Incredibly weak springs in there, so it's very easy to hold it down. And I believe in the current versions of this, they just got rid of the trigger entirely, which is what they probably should have done, because who wants to hold the thing down all the time? I think it's like a switch or something on the most recent one. So mine hasn't broke, and I have always appreciated that they made the trigger really easy to pull. But I also kind of wish it didn't have a trigger.
I think I actually, for other reasons, just got a new one, and it still has the same trigger mechanism. But anyway,
I might be thinking of some other feature they changed. But anyway, if they haven't, they should get rid of the trigger.
Yeah. Anyway, and to answer your question, Casey, about how good they are, the problem is they're not super good at being vacuums. Like, they're okay at being vacuums, but they're really convenient, and so it just doesn't. It doesn't really matter that they're not great vacuums. It matters that that's the one you're going to grab and use the most often. The same way, like, your phone is not a great camera, but it's an okay camera, and it's always there, and you're always going to use it, and you're going to be using it way more than you use your better camera. You know, even though you have a better camera, it's the same.
But
kind
it
of
does
thing.
Have the thing I'll say for the Dyson handheld is they do have a lot of suction for their size and weight, right? Because I've had a lot of handheld vacuums over the years, starting with the, you know, my parents' Dustbuster back when Dustbusters were a thing, and they came in beige. Yeah. Those were terrible, and I've had other handheld ones over the years, and the Dyson handheld, like, you know, per unit mass, like suction per unit mass is really good on it, as long as you keep it clean. Yeah. Everything else about it is a little cheap, and the battery dies pretty quickly, and they're really expensive to replace, but still the best handheld I've found, but it has not made it to my good products list, because I feel like it's just too expensive.
Yeah, and they're not amazing products. They're just decent products, and the competition is worse, as far as I know. Anyway, so my trigger broke. I had to replace it. It became one of these projects like, all right, first of all, you know, you order the replacement trigger. It gets here, you know, so that's 4 or 5 days. Then I have the replacement. I start taking the vacuum apart based on YouTube videos that tell me how to take stuff apart. And I realize, oh, I don't have a screwdriver that can reach down this long, skinny hole to get to the screw, like this deeply recessed screw. So now I got to order some skinny screwdriver. There goes another 4 days, 5 days. Right? Then I finally get it in there. I finally get down. I get in there. I need another screwdriver. This time I need a Torx bit on the end of a long, skinny screwdriver. All right, 4 more days.
Read ahead of the instructions, Marco. Find out which tools you're going to need.
Well, they're all just YouTube videos. They're not good at documentation. Anyway, so then eventually, I finally have all the tools I need. I finally get to the trigger, which, by the way, is hilariously complicated and hostile to get to. Like it's like repairing a butterfly keyboard. Like it's just you have to take apart the entire thing, and you're really diving. You have to like bend these terminals. Like it's a ridiculous process. I finally get in there. And I put, and I was smart. I bought a metal trigger so it wouldn't break. I go to put the metal trigger on. It doesn't fit without bending it because it's like you have to like bend and like snap it on. And the moment I bend it even slightly to get it to fit, it breaks.
Oh, it's stupendous.
So, order plastic ones. Another 5 days.
I'm not sure I agree with the actor in that sentence, if there was one.
I broke it. Okay,
yes,
I broke it.
I think that's more accurate.
But I was trying. I'm like, is there any way I can get this to somehow snap on?
Wait, was it the wrong part?
No, it was the right part, but it's one of those things. This isn't from Dyson. This is like Amazon randos.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. But especially for the batteries, I would not recommend buying the much cheaper ones from Amazon.
Oh, batteries definitely. I wouldn't. No, yeah. But a little plastic piece that Dyson misdesigned from the start. No. Anyway, so the Amazon ones have like more plastic in the right areas. Anyway, so finally, another 5 days go by. I finally get my plastic ones today. I finally put it back on and reassembled it, and it works. And it took such a ridiculously long time, and it was so not worth it. If I'm honest with you, like I must have lost like 5 hours to this project at least.
Oh my word!
Like I'm like this. I
probably still worth it because you don't want to buy another one of those. They're just too expensive.
I know. Well, but the one I was repairing was like 5 years old, so it's like it wasn't super new, but it's like it's almost not worth it. Anyway. Even though I hate these things, they still are the ones I go for the most, and I do the most vacuuming in the house, so I guess that's important.
Well, I'm glad you mended something. John, there's some exciting news.
It's old news. I just want to mention it again. I'm still selling my shirts, and since they're only sold every 5 years, I made the sale extra, extra long because I do not want to hear people say, oh, I just missed the sale. This sale's running. It's running so long. I apologize to the people who ordered their shirts already. They're like, when is my shirt coming? Like, the sale's not even over yet. It ends Saturday, August 12th. If you want a Hypercritical shirt, I hope you're hearing this before Saturday, August 12th. Do the Casey thing and like pull over to the side of the road and order it. Like, don't set it off to later because they're not coming back for 5 years. I'm excited, by the way, that I think so it's 2028 they'll be back. That means in 10 years after that it'll be 2038, which is the 32-bit rollover of the Unix epoch, I think. So that'll be a fun one. But anyway, don't wait. If you want a shirt, get one. That's what they're here for. For all the people who have these shirts and they're wearing out, or they didn't get one last time and they want one, Hypercritical shirts, go to hypercritical.co/shirt before August 12th.
Hypercritical.co/shirt. If you're listening to this now, like John alluded to, please pull over to the side of the sidewalk if you're in New York, to the side of the road if you're almost anywhere else, and go ahead, take out your phone, hypercritical.co/shirt.
What if you're on one of those giant escalators for the London Underground? Like, then you have enough space to like squeeze it.
No,
right?
Don't do it then, because then you're not going to notice when the top of the or bottom of the escalator comes, and you're just going to like fall over and cause a big mess.
Oh, yeah,
wait until you're off the escalator and then step to the side.
Well, yeah. And plus, what side of the escalator do you stop on? Because they drive on the wrong side of the road. Do they also walk on the wrong side?
It's like
of the
tipping.
Road?
There's no way to tell what to do.
It's so true. Anyway, hypercritical.co/shirt. We got a piece of follow up from Wilson Martinez, and Wilson writes, "I can't figure out who is who when listening. Can you say your names in the next podcast so I can put a name to a voice? Well, I'm Casey, and I'm the normal one. And you can take that however you would like. Marco, how would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Marco, and I'm the jerk.
John.
You have to say more. The whole point of the segment is you get to hear our voices. This is John. This is what my voice sounds like. It's a little bit like Kermit the Frog. I don't think my voice sounds anything like the other two. I think we have very distinct voices, but you might not know. So if you're wondering who's John, that's me. S-I-R-A-C, USA, Syracuse. That's me. This is my voice. You're hearing my voice right now. See how much content I'm giving them? So they'll know this is my voice. Whereas they just heard Casey briefly and they've already forgotten what he sounds like. And Marco said like two words and then Casey laughed over him. So they don't know who Marco is, but they know who I am.
They'll figure out the rest.
Yeah, it'll be fine. My voice is my passport. Verify me.
Who said that?
That was Casey's Casey the one speaking. Who makes
the every time we speak there, you have to say, "Hi, this is John. I'm speaking now."
Hi, this is Tim.
No, you're confusing people. Now they think you're Tim. You have to go back and say you're Casey. The reason I put this in the show notes is because I wanted like a chapter marker to send people because lots of people can't distinguish our voices and we don't introduce ourselves. And I apologize for that, but it's just part of the show format. But from now on, if someone asks, I'll save this in a little notes document and I'll send it to them and they'll be able to listen to this and they'll hear me saying, yes, this is John. This is what my voice sounds like. I mumble.
We couldn't have done a better job of this to introduce people to who we are.
Who's talking? I don't recognize that voice.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, sorry.
Hi, this is Casey.
Is Marco. Over.
No, it's happening again.
Just every time we talk, it's like IRC. We have to prefix it with our name. Marco colon. Casey. No, I'm screwing it up now. Edit that out, Marco. We're going to confuse people.
No. Oh my gosh. The funny thing is, like, I don't know, something like 2 years ago, I got a burr up my keister about this. Hi, this is Casey. Like 2 years ago, I got a burr up my keister about this. Casey got a burr up his own keister about this.
Why are you
put
putting
together,
burrs up, you know, there?
Just bear with me.
He got a burr. He didn't say how it got there. It's passive voice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I bet doctors hear a lot of that. Like, it got there. I don't know how it got there.
One in a million shot, doc.
Yeah.
One in a million. Anyway, so I had put together a meet your hosts page on the ATP website, which is there. It's been there this whole time. It's the call's coming from inside the house. Yes, atp.fm/hosts. And I put this together a while ago. And the funny thing is, I put together a blurb for Marco and for John and myself. And I think both of them tweaked the blurb that I gave them at least a little. My blurb is two sentences.
I would never leave a semicolon in my blurb.
Oh, we got to change this. It links to my Twitter handle. Come on.
Oh, this was years ago. Stay with me. Anyway, the point
I've gotten
is,
taller since then.
I don't think you have.
The point, this is going so far off the rails, it's ridiculous. But anyways, the funny thing to me, though, is that Marco, I think you at least acknowledged the existence of this page, you know, 2 years ago, whatever it was, and then basically ignored it, which is, you know, typical Marco fashion. That's neither good nor bad. It's just, you know, typical Marco. John, however, could not let this thing that no other human has seen until today stand and triple the size of his little blurb, making it far more involved than either of the two of us.
Yeah, because you have to, if you're going to tell people who you are, say something to distinguish who you are. Like, you may know me from such things as, you know, Troy McClure style.
Anyways, it probably should be updated. But what I was envisioning was not only would we have this image of us and little blurbs about each of us, but I envisioned having, you know, like Marco microphone review style, you know, snippets of us talking like from the show or perhaps even introducing ourselves or whatever. This has been such a train wreck that we cannot extract any of this to use on this page.
That's exactly correct for our show.
Yes.
It should be a giant train wreck. Although it occurs to me that it sounds kind of, introducing ourselves, that's what they do on the earnings calls, you know?
Yep.
That's why you're doing this. Hi, this is Tim or whatever. This is not Tim. This is still John. Don't be confused.
Oh, my God.
We're doing a terrible job of this. This is amazing.
Now, don't you appreciate the fact that we don't introduce ourselves or refer to ourselves by name most of the time?
Right.
I think at this point, they've all stopped listening.
Yeah, it's so true.
That's what chapter markers are for, baby. If you already knew our voices, you already skipped this chapter.
That's true. Well, but then you missed out on this delightful.
You missed out
train
this.
Wreck.
What you missed out learning about atp.fm/host, which is a terrible page that we need to either update or delete.
I feel like now we can't. Like, now we have to leave it.
No, it has to stay there. We'll fix it. We'll just get rid of the Twitter handles and put in our Mastodon handles and stuff. We'll fix it. We'll work on it.
We'll workshop this. All right. So, breaking news as of a day or two ago. I don't even remember. I think it was Monday, and we're recording on Wednesday. Apple Vision Pro Labs developer kit and compatibility evaluation sign up are live. You can go to a website that we will link in the show notes. And you can ask to work with Apple, as it says in the URL, in order to do any of these things. So they're starting extremely soon. I forget exactly when, but I think in the next like week or so, at least the Cupertino ones are happening. And then there's going to be labs in London, Munich, Shanghai, Singapore, and Tokyo. That is where you can go in and use a Vision Pro, presumably with your app, and tweak it and work on it and so on. They can take your app and do a compatibility evaluation. So they run it kind of like App Review kind of sort of style. I mean, none of the three of us have any issues with App Review, so that's awesome. And they'll tell you, hey, it's a pile of garbage, or hey, there's a video player here that you need to look at, or whatever the case may be. Or maybe they'll talk about copyright. And then finally, you can apply to get a Vision Pro developer kit, which we should talk a little bit about the details with regard to that as well here in a moment. But all of those things you can do right now. And I think that signups for the labs, at least, I believe those close very, very soon, like in the next couple of days, if I'm not mistaken. I have not yet signed up for any of this, in no small part because I have not done anything Vision Pro related. Like I would like to do some of this. I am enthusiastic about the idea of trying the Vision Pro, but I have done literally nothing. And so I don't know if I'm a particularly great candidate for any of these things. Perhaps if I can ever get my head above sand or above water or whatever with regard to call sheet, then maybe I'll apply for one if it's not too late. But Marco, I assume you have applied for all the things?
I have actually applied only for the dev kit, only because my actual app for Vision Pro is nowhere near ready, because it is only my, like, the rewrite of my app, which at this point is, I would describe it as maybe 20% or 30%, you know, done. It's really you know, anywhere close to shipping. And so I applied for the dev kit kind of optimistically. And I even, you know, they have you explain in like 200 words or so, like, you know, why you want one and why you should have one, basically. It's like a job application. And I even wrote in there, I'm like, look, this is not a visually compelling app. This is a three column list view showing lists of podcast episodes, and it's not like a super immersive experience. So if that's what you're looking for, no problem, no hard feelings, I understand. However, what I'm looking for is basically, I want to know how the audio system works. I want to know how background audio works. I want to know how my audio engine, which is pretty low level, interacts with the hardware. I want to be able to play with different audio configurations and options and things like that. So that's why I want access to the hardware. But it's not a super visually, you know, massive immersion kind of app. So, you know, I don't think I'm going to get one in all likelihood. And frankly, I probably shouldn't get one for all those reasons. Like, if they have a fairly limited number of them, which it sounds like is going to be the case, and if they want to only give it to, like, really high-impact visual kind of apps, there's no way I should have one. But if they happen to want to give one to a podcast player that is showing a list of episodes and, you know, playback controls, I would love to actually use one. Because I think it's going to be very difficult to develop good apps for this platform without actually having one. Because we don't know how any of the controls or the mechanisms or the conventions actually feel and work and look and practice. Like right now, I'm doing a whole bunch of iPhone design work. I'm doing, you know, because I'm in the middle of this rewrite, plus I'm working on my iOS 17 widgets for my old code base that will, I'm hopefully going to have iOS 17 widgets ready shortly. And so I'm doing a lot of design work where, like, I'm laying out interfaces on the iPhone app. And yes, I have the simulator, but on my desk right now are three iPhones. Because of various sizes and ages and things, because you have to feel it, you have to try it. It's funny. I happen to have dug up what I believe is my first ever podcast appearance. Because they had Chuck Joyner on Mac Power Users this past week, and I remembered. I'm pretty sure his show that I did in April of 2010, I think. This was between the iPad's announcement and its release. So, which is kind of funny, like, listening back. I mean, first of all, it is not... I was not good on this show. I was like, calling in from a phone. I sound terrible. And I spoke extremely slowly for some reason. I don't know what has changed. Maybe I've just had a lot of coffee in the intervening, you know, 13 years.
New York working its magic.
Yeah, right, I guess. But anyway, I re-listened to this, and it was interesting. Like, I was listening back, because this was the time period where we spent a big part of the show kind of talking about our expectations of what the iPad would be like, because, again, it was announced, but it wasn't available yet. And I was able to develop for it. Like, they released the SDK before we all had hardware, and And by the way, and please don't, if you listen to this, please know, like, I'm not proud of, like, this. It's very dated in a number of ways. I made a couple of assumptions about a male audience a few times that I feel really bad about now. Like, please be kind. But anyway, it was a similar time period where we had this hardware announcement, and they showed off the hardware, but nobody had it yet, and we were all developing apps for it without having access to the hardware yet. And the problem was that I was saying, like, we don't know how this is going to feel in our hands. We don't know how certain things will work yet. And what I ended up shipping for Instapaper, which was the app I was using at the time, which is what the interview was mostly about, what I ended up shipping for Instapaper's first iPad app was just a stretched-out iPhone app. And it sucked. It was terrible. And I replaced it as quickly as possible with a total redesign. And I fear... that what's going to happen with Vision Pro is we're all going to make these, you know, versions of our apps in the simulator between now and whenever we can get our hands on a real one, probably, you know, early next year at the best case. And then we're going to actually get it and realize, oh, this is totally wrong. Because you can tell, like, when I'm doing the iPhone work, I can do this great design in the simulator. And the first time I run it on a device, I can instantly tell, oh, that's wrong. That's too small, or that's too big, or that doesn't work, or that doesn't look right, or it doesn't feel right. You really need to use the hardware to really know how something feels. And it doesn't need to be something super flashy or involved or innovative to hit those walls and to realize you've made a design mistake. It can be a very simple, like, table view app, and you can instantly know, oh, this doesn't work right on the hardware. And with this hardware in particular, this is even more different than when we were going from iPhone to iPad. Because at least iPhone to iPad, at least first of all, the interface looked and worked very similarly to the iPhone, and it was still a touchscreen. So it was far more similar than what we have now, going from literally anything to the Vision Pro, which is controlled totally differently, looks totally different, works totally different, the app environment, like, everything about it is so different, down to the fundamentals of how you interact with it. So I suspect this is going to be a platform where you really need the hardware to really design an app that's worth using at all. So that's why I applied to the developer kit. And I kind of feel bad that even if I get one, I'm going to have very little to show in my app for maybe 6 months. Like, that's, I think 6 months from now, I could probably have a working version with the new code base that actually has, like, a useful amount of features that could, you know, be released on its own. But that, like, you know, between now and then, I'm not going to have much to show for it. So, like, that's why I didn't even apply for the labs yet, because I have nothing to run yet. I didn't apply for the, you know, please run my app and tell me if it's broken test flight thing, because, again, like, I'm not even to that point yet. So anyway, I applied, and then, assuming they maybe possibly ever say yes in the next, you know, 3 months, that'll give me time to actually figure out how I'm going to comply with the security requirements.
Indeed. Okay, so before we talk about that, John, did you apply for any of these things? I presume not.
No, I don't have any Vision Pro apps that are working. None of my apps. It's not relevant to my apps. I don't have any ideas for Vision Pro apps. I'm not going to get one.
Fair enough. All right, so a friend of the show, James Thompson, was tooting on Mastodon when this all happened. James said, you know, needless to say, I applied to get the Vision Pro developer kit for pCalc and probably more interesting Dice by pCalc, which is a dice simulator you can use for, say, role-playing games or whatever. Then James continues, the security requirements for keeping the developer kit safe read more like a PlayStation developer kit and unlike anything else I've seen with pre-release Apple hardware, for example, the Apple Silicon DTK. So this is a little bit long, but I think it's worth reading. This is now Apple's words as a part of the developer kit, like signup or whatever. Apple says, you agree that all access to, usage of, and storage use of the developer kit will be in private, secure, workspace accessible only by you and your authorized developers. For example, fully enclosed with solid doors, floors, walls, and ceiling, and locks that can be engaged when the developer kit is in use. You must ensure that unauthorized persons, including any family, friends, roommates, or household employees, my word, do not access, view, handle, or use the DK, the developer kit.
Oh, my butler can't use it.
Right, exactly. Very, very, very Silicon Valley, right? When in use, the DK should be in your positive control on your person or within your direct line of sight at all times. You must ensure that the DK is passcode protected. Never leave the DK unattended. When not in use, turn off the DK and store it in its locked Pelican case in a locked space that only you have access to. For example, a locked room or closet, a safe, or a locked drawer. The DK may not be moved from or taken away from its shipped to address by you or your authorized developers without Apple's prior written consent. If you will be away from your workspace for more than 10 days, consult with your Apple point of contact about how to keep the DK safe while you are away. You agree to restrict access to the DK to you and your authorized developers and take all reasonable precautions to safeguard the DK from loss or theft. I mean, if I get one, my in-home office does not have a lock that has a key.
Yeah, you need a new house.
And it has windows. Like, does that mean I can't use it? Like, what the
You just lock? Have to have solid doors, floors, walls, and ceiling, and locks that keep me engaged when it's not used. I'm going
to
go out on a limb
and
say...
No one else is allowed to view it. So you can only use it when you have locked yourself in the room.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think pretty much zero people are going to fully comply with this, because it's basically impossible human nature-wise to fully comply with this, even if you have the best of intentions, because it demands so much of you that's out of the ordinary. And the normal human mind will rebel against the absurdity of these requirements for a product that has already been announced and tried by the press, although not us. It's not like, you know, if before this was revealed, I can understand something like this, but it's just impossible to comply with this. Like, unless you have a compliance officer there who is like checking all the time, there's no way, even with the best of intentions, you're going to like, it just requires too much. So I'm not quite sure why. Maybe this is just boilerplate they have for when they like, you know, like Unity has been working on stuff for like 2 years. So like before it was announced, I can imagine agreements like this being enforced in a big company. But this developer kit thing is open to anyone who wants to apply. So like individual developers who work from their home are going to get this device. They can't comply with this. Like Unity might be able to because they're a big company and they actually have compliance officers and stuff, right? And there's millions of dollars online if they screw up or whatever. But individual developers won't. I think it is interesting that they're being so super cautious about it, but I do wonder if this is like leftover language from like the before times before WWDC.
Yeah, well, because this is the level of security that you would have if they're like, you know, if they're you know, showing off some new hardware soon, and they go to your company a couple weeks ahead of time and like, here, try this new iPad, make your app for it, we'll show it in the keynote. Like, this is that level of security. Although when that has happened, it's been even higher in the sense that usually they put it in some like tremendous enclosure, so you can't even really see what the device looks like outside of the screen. But
yeah,
anyway.
sometimes they'll have you come to them to work on it in a place that they control. Like, but all those situations that you're describing involve companies, and companies have people whose job it is to like comply with these things and not get the company sued because companies have a lot of money and there's contract. Like, that all makes perfect sense. But hey, individual developer, come throw your hat in the ring to sign up for this thing and we'll send you a developer kit. Boy, this is overkill for that.
Yeah, but that being said, I fully expect that only companies that have those kind of resources are likely to get developer kits. I think everyone else is going to be told.
I think individuals, maybe not you, but I think individuals will get it. There's enough individuals with interesting apps that Apple wants to have a developer kit, and I think they're going to send it to them. I think there will be individuals who work out of their home who are going to get a DK.
Yeah, I mean, I genuinely believe, I really, really do, that Underscore will end up with one of these. As
oh,
an
yeah,
example.
He should, actually.
And he should. So, I mean, I would be surprised if there aren't at least a handful of, you know, hashtag blessed individuals that get them. But the thing that struck me about this is, I haven't even applied, and I tend to be a straight shooter. I tend to try not to break the rules. And so I would probably do a best effort on following these rules. But leaving all of this aside, like all things being equal, if I got one of these, of course I'd be like, Aaron, you have to try this out. You know, why would she not? And it occurred to me as I was thinking about
this. Well, now you're never going to get one.
Oh, no, totally. Right.
No, you can make her an authorized developer.
You already said on a podcast where you identified yourself by name so they know which voice is which, that
fault.
You are not going to comply with this agreement. So forget it, Casey. You're
yeah,
not
it's all
one.
Your fault, John. I was okay when they thought it was you. But anyways, it occurred to me that there is every possibility for this thing to phone home. And, you know, it's aware, presumably, if I don't know if it's like a retina scan or whatever the scan was, but to identify who's using it. It hypothetically will know if somebody else was, you know, put this thing on and has tried it. And is it going to phone home to Apple if you do that? I was talking to my friend Brad about this. And, you know, Brad had pointed out, you know, oh, if somebody walks up to you, is it going to be like, uh-oh, somebody was in the presence of this thing? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not sure that
self-destruct
that's really,
on your face.
Right? Like, I don't think Apple is quite that evil, vindictive, whatever.
No,
but
they're not.
But it is hypothetically possible. And that kind of creeps me out.
I mean, look, and I'm sure in their terms, I'm sure it says something like they can do whatever they want. But no, I wouldn't be worried about that. I'd be worried about, like, you know, disappointing dad. Like, that's that's kind of what I'd be worried about here, you know, because in many ways, you know, it's similar to, like, there's been a couple of times in the past where I've been trusted with pre-release review hardware. That wasn't at all the same thing as this. I mean, that was like, you know, hey, we have this MacBook Pro that we're releasing in, you know, a week. We've already announced it. You know, here you can take one to review for a week, you know, and that's very different from this is a brand new platform that is unlike everything we've ever shipped before, and it isn't shipping to the public for 7 or 8 months, probably. Like, that's a very different situation, obviously. So I would expect this to have a lot of security. And, you know, the reality is what I should probably do is go to a lab, and I'm sure I would have not that much trouble getting a slot in a lab. The problem is I don't want to fly all to California. That's a lot. And so, look, I'll do it if I have to, but certainly not yet. I mean, I would wait until, you know, closer to release time before I did that. But that's a much larger thing for me. You know, if they have it in New York, I'd be there. No question, I'd be there. But
right, you know, that's the thing. I was very surprised that it was, you know, left coast or get the hell out. You know, I really would have expected them to do something in New York somewhere. And I mean, I heard through the grapevine that there is an Apple establishment in New York, like, where presumably this sort of thing could happen. So I don't know. I was very, very surprised that, you know, they're telling everyone to go to California or Penn State.
I thought they had maybe just the compatibility labs in multiple cities across the world.
There are, yeah, but the only one in the U.S. is in California.
Oh, right.
Yeah, there's like London. I think there's somewhere.
It's London, Munich, Shanghai, Singapore, and Tokyo.
There you go.
Anyway, but yeah, this is quite amusing to me. And I mean, I in the defense of Apple, like, I understand what they're going for here. And certainly, I think if I were in their shoes, my approach would be, let's, you know, put the fear of God into all these people and make them think that they have to be super strict with it, even if they really didn't care and all they cared about was, you know, not having a video demo or anything like that. You know, don't go to YouTube, don't go to The Verge. Or
yeah, I mean, I think this is like a butt covering for Apple doesn't want is someone like posting a picture of here's what the developer kit looks like, right? You know, because that'll be a whole thing.
Yeah, or they don't want tearing it down and doing the iFixit, you know.
And they don't want you to say, well, I complied with your agreement, but someone sneakily took a picture. And it's like, look, if you comply with our agreement, there'd be no way for someone to sneakily take a picture of it because our agreement is so airtight. So no matter what happens, it's your fault, which is what lawyers do.
Yeah, exactly. But the other thing, too, is like, you know, because I'm giving all these statements, assuming that it will be fairly hard to get, you know, developer access to this. That's assuming there's a whole bunch of people trying. And that's probably a safe assumption, you know, in absolute terms, but in relative terms, I think this platform, like, I think Apple needs developers to be interested in this platform a little harder than they normally have to push. You know, like with the iPhone, they don't really have to push at all. We come to them. You know, with the other platforms, like, they have to do a little bit of pushing because, like, it's less compelling or less, like, gotta have it for developers. And I think Vision OS is going to have as I mentioned before, I think it's going to have a pretty gradual start. It's not going to have a lot of unit sales to start. It's not going to be easy to get for a lot of people for a while due to lots of things, not least of which is the price, of course, but also, you know, the manufacturing and country availability and stuff like that. So it's going to be a while before this platform really ramps up with developer interest. And I think Apple, you know, it might be the case that any of us who are interested in making apps for it, they might be like, yes, please, here, you know, we don't know. Yeah, I guess we'll find out. It remains to be seen, like, how competitive these developer resources actually are. I hope there's tons of people wanting to develop for this platform, because frankly, I think it's pretty cool. And I'm hoping to be a user of this platform, and I wanted to have a healthy software ecosystem. I also, I've heard from a lot of people who are kind of like, in the wait and see camp. And as I mentioned in my Vision Pro Challenges segment a few weeks back, I don't think a lot of big companies are going to jump on board quite yet. So it's probably going to be largely down to independent enthusiasts and developers like Underscore and, you know, possibly me, and, you know, we'll see, you know, whatever John comes up with and hopefully Casey can port call sheet to it and everything, but like, which actually I think it would be a pretty good use for it.
Yeah, I do as well. It's not lack of enthusiasm. It's just lack of time. There's only one of me and I'm trying to get the damn thing out the door, which we'll talk about here in a minute. But yeah, I mean, I think call sheet does make sense for it, but I can't, well, maybe I could, but I don't, I am of the kind that I can't in good conscience apply for a developer kit before I at least have something to show for it. Even if Apple doesn't necessarily care, I care. You know, I want to have a little bit of my head around. I want to have my head a little bit around what all this means, and I'm not there yet, but hopefully I will be soon.
Yeah, it doesn't really help that I have to rewrite all my widgets first, and then also they redesigned all of watchOS, and like, there's like all this other stuff I have to get to first, really,
right,
for this fall. But anyway, we'll get there.
All right, and then a friend of the show, Steve Trout Smith, also noted that the Vision Pro loan period is until 90 days after the launch of the retail product in the United States. It would make sense for Apple to extend that period in countries that have no retail launch of the Vision Pro, unless it expects developers with in-progress apps to either pause development or try to figure out how to import one from the U.S. That's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, really, honestly, at this point, like as I was saying earlier, I think if you're going to release an app for this platform, you need to be trying it on hardware first. And, you know, so hopefully you get the hardware in some form or another, whether it's, you know, at a lab or you get the developer kit or it comes out and you buy it, then you ship it. But if you have no way to get one of these afterwards, I don't see how you continue to maintain an app on this platform.
Yeah, definitely agree. Anything else about the developer kits? Going once, going twice,
nope.
Sold. All right. I was on vacation last week, as was John, which is why we recorded early. And for the first time ever, we actually timed them in parallel rather than serially. So I was very proud of John and myself. But nevertheless, that's neither here nor there. So when we last left our hero, that hero would be me. Hi, this is Casey. When we last left our hero, I had submitted call sheet to the App Store with a build that I could release, but I knew there were a few fixes left to be done. The screenshots weren't exactly what I wanted. I just wanted to get something across the finish line before I left for vacation. And I don't think I made it clear that was the real push when we spoke about this last a couple of weeks ago, but I really wanted to get something through App Review before vacation. So at least I could go on vacation, not stressing about it, knowing, hey, I've made it across the finish line at least once. I have something I could release if I really wanted to. Everything's kosher. Everything's good. As we discussed, and as John got extremely fired up about, which was very kind of both of you guys to get my back like that. But anyways, as we discussed last time, which was 2 weeks ago, I got three different rejections. The first was they want an unclickable URL in the app description. Fine, I did that. Then I got a rejection for there being a video player in the app that doesn't have a video player. Fine, we clarified that. Then I got a rejection for using Disney and Pixar copyrighted material in the screenshots that I provided to Apple, and I got rejected. And so I wrote Apple because this was happening as close to real time as one could be with App Review. You know, they would send something within a half an hour, 45 minutes, I would send something back. Within about an hour after that, they would send something back, and it was going back and forth. And so in my ignorance, my naivete, I don't know how to pronounce that word. You know what I'm thinking of. Because I'm a dope, I thought, hey, let's just get on the phone. You call me or I can call you or whatever. Let's just get on the phone. Let's hammer this out in like 5-10 minutes. We'll get it done. It'll be fine. And they said, sure, we'll call you back in 3 to 5 business days. Well, 3 to 5 business days meant that when I was on the beach in Cape Charles, I received a phone call from Apple. So I ran to the dune, which was far away from all the people and the music and all that. And
you're
I spoke
to keep
to,
off the dunes, Casey.
Yeah, well, I ran to the cutout through the dune that you use to get to the beach. See, I forget with whom I'm speaking. By the way, that was Marco, everybody.
Oh, yes.
that lives on the beach. Hi,
I'm the chief interrupter.
Casey. I don't know if that's true, but
it's
either
definitely
way,
true.
But I spoke with a gentleman who only identified himself as Richard. Hand to God, he was incredibly kind and incredibly patient and incredibly chill. Like, I probably shouldn't state this publicly because it's mildly embarrassing, but I cannot remember having a phone call that I was this, maybe not scared, nervous, worried, just a ball of emotion about. Like, my heart was pumping a mile a minute. In retrospect, I should have done a Apple Watch like heartbeat doodad. You know what I'm thinking of? And like actually read my heartbeat.
Did you get the alert that's
that,
like, hey, your heart rate's
no.
Yeah, it looks like you're talking to App Review.
Right, exactly. It's so true.
You want to begin a workout? You know, definitely. People are always doing those fake icons for different kinds of workouts. They should do a talking to App Review workout. Someone
totally.
On that.
100% true. So anyways, so hand, I mean, I cannot tell you how I was standing still, or maybe I was pacing because I always walk around when I'm on the phone. I don't know how I sit still for these podcasts, but I was not really moving and I was like mildly out of breath. I was so nervous for this phone call. And truth be told, Richard was so nice and so chill. And based on his demeanor alone, I really didn't need to be this worked up, but I built this call up over the last several days because I think it was Tuesday, if memory serves, that I said, hey, why don't you call me? And I didn't get the call until the following Monday. It's something like that. I might have those days slightly wrong. But anyways, I had built this up in my head. I've been stressing about it through the beginning of our vacation, and I'm just freaking the F out, right? And he gets me on the phone. Well, he left a message because I guess I was in the water at the time. Then I come back and he tried again, I guess, just a few minutes later. He actually left his phone number, which is this might have been worth the rejection just to get a phone number for somebody at Apple. So this might be a hidden golden ticket that I didn't realize. But anyways, he left his phone number in my voicemail, which I've since, you know, saved and created contact for, blah, blah, blah. And then he called back and we got on the phone. And one of the first things he said, which kind of made me chuckle, and I don't remember the words verbatim, but as close as I can remember, he said, I just want to let you know that I have to tell you this call cannot be recorded and I do not consent to it being recorded, which I thought was quite funny.
I mean, that's an interesting sentiment to express, even though those aren't the exact words, because cannot be recorded? Well, Richard, I'm not sure you're right about that. I'm pretty sure it can be recorded. And right. I register your lack of consent, but I happen to live in a state that requires only one of us to consent, and I consent. So right, where are we now, Richard? But that's not a good way. That's not a good way to start that call. So I'm
no, it is not. Yeah, no, it is not.
It's like this call could be recorded. It probably shouldn't. You probably should not record.
As far as you know, I'm not recording this, Richard.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And if you recall, I did briefly look at the state laws or the Commonwealth laws here in Virginia. And as far as I can tell, it is a single party consent state. Now, California is not, if I remember correctly. So I don't know how that would work out, but it doesn't.
Yeah, matter. I mean, anyways, you can do whatever you want within the law, but then also Apple can just reject your app forever. So think about that. Yep,
there's that too. I did not record it because I was standing on a beach. So he gets me on the phone and he basically says, I've taken a look at your situation. Your app is good to go. Do you want me to release this one, or do you want to send another bug fix through? What do you want to do?
I want to pause you here, Casey, because one strain of feedback we got after the show where I was complaining about your rejection and how ridiculous it was from people with experience with copyright and dealing with IP law and ownership of stuff. And many of those people were super duper confident that we were a bunch of dummies and just didn't understand how copyright law worked. And I think all of us were fairly deferential, saying we're not lawyers, we don't understand how copyright works. But one thing we do know, and what I tried to emphasize in that episode, is there are many apps like this on the App Store, and there is no way that all of those apps, some of which are made by individual developers like Casey, have gotten all the clearances that these supposed experts in copyright law think we need to get. And I think Richard saying, oh no, your app is fine, pretty firmly puts the decision in our camp, saying we were right. You don't need contracts with every movie and television production company in the world to produce an app like Casey's. In fact, Apple said it's fine.
Yep. And we had, I could look it up. I have my phone next to me, but I would say we had a 5 to 10 minute conversation, but the TLDR, the short of it was fine. And they were good to release as if I was good to release. And so I genuinely have no idea if I got through because of ATP, if I got through because John Siracusa was upset and Marco Arment were upset. I don't know
I think the app is fine. But that's the whole point. There's so many apps like this. If just a single human who understands anything about the App Store looked at it, they'd be like, oh yeah, there's a tons of apps like this. Is there anything wrong? No? Then why are we stopping it?
Well, and also, I feel like, oh, by the way, this is Marco. I feel like that all that you need to know is it's now resolved. That's it. Like, don't dwell too much on why.
What is it? Past performance has no whatever implications on future, they tell you about the stock stuff. This doesn't mean that the app won't get rejected for the exact same reason next time you submit it. That's the magic of the App Store.
Yep, that is the magic of the App Store. And I asked him a few things, not in a challengy way, like, hey, I think at one point I said, hey, for the future, should I have handled this differently? Like, did I do something wrong here? And I was very deferential. I was very, I was trying to say in so many words, like, look, I don't want to waste your time. I actually might have even said that to him. I don't want to waste your time.
I think
time,
I know what you were trying to say, but in a very nice way.
Exactly. I mean, I was trying to say
this whole process has been BS.
Well, yes. I was trying to say this was a waste of everyone's time, especially
yes,
mine.
Exactly.
What should I have done for the next time? And again, he was very kind, very chill. He said, no, you're good. You didn't do anything wrong. It's all fine.
And you should have said, and Richard, what do you think you should do for next time? Is there anything that you want to talk about that maybe you could have done better?
Oh, that's very funny. So anyway, so we were on the phone for like 5 or 10 minutes, and he said, okay, you know, how do you want to proceed? Do you want to release this one? Well, and it was all pending developer release once it gets, you know, through app review. But I said, you know what? No, I'd like to see this cross the finish line. Would you go ahead and send it through, please? He said, absolutely. No problem. You know, I'll give you a call. It'll probably be a couple hours. We'll get it through. This was somewhere to the order of 1 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern time. He said, you know, it'll be an hour or two, and then we'll send it through. You'll see it's approved, blah, blah, blah. 6 o'clock Eastern time comes around. The app still hasn't passed review. I know that it's in review because you can see, you know, the state of things using App Store Connect, and, you know, and there's an app for that, I think also called App Store Connect. There's a website, blah, blah, blah. And I see that it's been in review for like a couple hours now. I am pooping my pants because the very kind Richard had told me unequivocally it's good to go. But I thought I was good to go before I even sent it to review, and it turns out I was wrong about that. So what's the deal? And right around the time I'm like spiraling into the depths of despair, I get a phone call from Apple, and it's Richard. And he says, hey, you're probably wondering what's going on. I said, yes, I am. There's something wrong on our end. I'm not entirely sure what it is, but we're working on it and we'll get it through. I promise. Okay. Are you sure? Yep. I'm totally sure. Would you like me to give you a call when it's through? Yes, please, because I'm really worried. He said, no worries, I will give you a call. And then it was actually, of course, it was like 10 minutes after that it all went through. He gave me another call. All was good. So sitting in the App Store right now, pending developer release, is the very first release of CallSheet. Being said, which I'm extremely excited for and I'm extremely thankful for. And actually, before I talk release plans, I should back up a half step. I'm sorry. I should have reordered this in the show notes. We got a lot of feedback from lawyers and people with, you know, amateur lawyers saying, as John had mentioned a moment ago, oh, it's absolutely copyright. Apple cannot accept anything like that. You're absolutely 100% going to have to use like Stable Diffusion to make fake poster art. I actually had somebody reach out to me. I wish I had their name in front of me, but they said, hey, I'm a producer on such and such, and I am giving you permission to use this thing that I have the rights to, which is very kind. I really appreciate that. It's hard to get
only,
you know,
700,000 more people you need to get agreements from. Okay.
Right, exactly. No, but I don't want to besmirch this fellow. It was very kind of him to say that, genuinely. But anyways, a lot of people said, you know, of course, this is never going to work. And a lot of other people said, oh, I've been through this. Here's what you need to do. And so the most concise example of this, and I think most easy to understand, was Ibrahim Thamim, who wrote, I just wanted to suggest something that might help with the App Store rejection you talked about in the last episode of ATP. I spent a lot of time with the same exact issue with my app that used the movie database API. What finally got them to accept the app was to include a note below in the review information section. It's weird, but this seems to be what they're looking for. Since then, I've been able to get multiple similar apps approved by providing this exact note. The note is as follows. As mentioned extensively in the app, all imagery and metadata used in this app is from the moviedb.org API. Therefore, any information regarding permission to use the images or metadata, please refer to, and then hit the movie database terms of use URL, which basically says, I am not a lawyer. Look, everything that's been uploaded to us, as part of, you know, uploading it to us, we are asking those who are uploading it that, do you have the rights to this? And they have attested yes. So if they have the rights to it, now we have the rights to it because they're granting us rights. And now we're granting you rights. So I think it's kind of like, you know, Spider-Man pointing at himself sort of situation.
I don't think that's how it works.
I like the fact that Ibrahim put the little FU at the beginning, which is like, as mentioned extensively in the app, which you may or may not have actually looked at. Like, that's right. I mean, it's kind of like uploading a web browser and saying, just so you know, every web page this web browser loads is on the web, and that content is not part of our application. And yet will still say, I don't know, I could browse porn, rejected.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of sort of, you know, superstition about do this and they got my thing through. But the problem is, like, it's such a random number generator, like AppReview. Like, is it, did I get through because of something that I did, or did it get through just because I was going to get through no matter what at that point? Like Richard said, Casey didn't need to change anything about his app. He didn't need to get agreements with every movie studio. He didn't need to do anything. His app as is was just plain fine, which is what we all thought, because again, there are apps that are very similar that are, I've been on the App Store for years and years, and why wouldn't Casey's be fine?
No, exactly. It's all about, you know, it's a bunch of humans and they make mistakes or they're afraid to, you know, step over a possible line or whatever else. And so as long as this system is human based, it's going to have human problems. It's going to be inconsistent. It's going to be, you know, they're going to mess up sometimes. You're going to get, you know, crappy reviewers sometimes. And if the system wasn't human based, if it was AI based or something, we would have different problems. We wouldn't have no problems. So, you know, it's just part of being an iOS developer is you got to play the system. You know, you have to know that, yeah, there's occasional landmines you're going to step on. You don't really know how certain things are going to go, and you kind of just build that into your expectations. And
but
you know,
it's
we
a
can
bad
rage
system,
and we can fight against it, and we can say AppReview sucks, we can say we shouldn't need to do this, etc. And that's all, you know, sometimes we need to fight that fight, but usually we just have to work within the system the way it is.
But see, here's the thing with the system. You mentioned that it being AI powered, like, oh, it could be worse, it could be like no humans involved, but like we have the worst of both worlds. Like we have fallible humans, but also we don't have the humanity that comes with them. Like the thing, what we would expect, maybe not in Casey's case, but in other cases where people get angry about things, is like in actual human relationships between humans or even just relationships between companies, a thing called reputation exists. There is a level of trust that gets built up. Like panic, the software developer panic, should be treated differently by Apple than I am. Or than Casey is, because they have such a long history of such high quality applications. There is trust built up from literal decades of working with this company and these same people. When humans relate to each other, it's not all the same. So AppReview, everybody's the same. Everyone's supposedly treated the same. That's supposed to be fair. But what it doesn't allow to happen is to, like, let's give panic the benefit of the doubt, right? Let's assume, you know, that they're not secretly doing, like, let's not assume the worst of them. Let's give them a reviewer who actually looks at their app and knows that it doesn't contain a video player. You know what I mean? Like, there should be different treatment. There is different treatment for Microsoft, Google, Adobe, you know, the big companies that are big competitors or that Apple needs or whatever. So that does exist, as we talked about. But I feel like the next level down, like if it's humans to humans, I want the advantages of it being a human-powered process in addition to the disadvantages. Now I just feel like we just get the disadvantages and there are no advantages, right? And whether that's an advantage, like, oh, Casey gets to talk, you know, because, you know, Casey assumed when he talked to a human, he'd be able to work it out, because at that point, he's getting higher bandwidth treatment. And to Casey's point earlier, wouldn't it have been easier to skip all that time that we wasted, both of our time and energy, before this 5-second phone call? This 5-second phone call, granted, it's not as scalable as, you know, people, after you can't be calling everybody on the phone or whatever. But if Apple had put the amount of effort they put into that phone call into one or two of those early reviews, this whole problem could have been avoided. So I still feel like, you know, I'm not saying that they have to be perfect. There's always going to be mistakes. But if it's going to be human powered, I want some of the advantages of human review. And part of those advantages is the ability to build up trust and a reputation over time for good developers, which, again, may not apply to Casey with his handful of apps that he's put out, but the other developers who
I want to developer.
No, right? But I'm just saying, like you know, some developer, he's not Panic, right? He's not Adobe. He's not Microsoft. He's not one of those giant companies. And he's also not a small developer who has, like, decades and decades of, you know, he's not Underscore. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, those type of relationships built up over time, saying, has Underscore been sneaking bad stuff in there? Is he stealing people's contacts, right? Is he making gambling apps for children? No. He's not doing any of that. So he should have a higher level of trust than, hey, we've never heard of this developer and I have no idea what this app is.
Well, but on the other hand, though, I mean, look, again, the system has a lot of flaws, but I also love the fact that everyone gets a similar level of BS. You know, like that there aren't, I mean, look, and there are,
there
was, certain,
I mean, there is, just for Adobe and Google and Microsoft and, you know.
Yeah, but, like, you know, Facebook,
Netflix,
you know, Facebook isn't able to break a certain rule much more than we can. But, you know, when they break
Facebook gets it in the other direction, they get extra scrutiny.
Well, but, like, when they break a rule, they still can't release the app, but they aren't kicked out of the developer program for
it. Yeah, exactly. Right.
You know, it's like there is some big company privilege for sure. And there have been, like, you know, occasional special deals made. Like, you know, there was that rumor that seemed pretty well backed that, like, Netflix was not paying the 30% for some time.
Yeah, as I've said in many years in the past, that's appropriate. Apple should do that. It makes sense to. It would be dumb not to do that.
Yeah, pretty much. Anyway, so like, you know, the system is not perfect, but it is overall it does work mostly the same for most people most of the time, and so that is a little more comforting, and that's probably better than the alternative of, like, you know, the big companies get, like, much better reviewers, and then the rest of us get only Casey's first level reviewer.
Right. So I think the point that Ibrahim and a few other people have said who have also used, you know, the stuff from the movie database is that they want I'm putting a lot of words in a lot of people's mouths here, but it seems to me that the general gist of it is that Apple wants to be able to say, look, this person or this company or whatever, at least on the surface, seems to have some sort of rights to the content that they're presenting. And by using the movie database API, they have granted me those rights. And presumably on the ingestion side, like I was saying a minute ago, whoever is uploading this stuff, they're claiming to have these rights. Doesn't mean they do, but at least they're claiming to. So the movie database feels like, for right or wrong, they're in the clear. I'm not saying that's factual. I'm just saying that that's what they feel like. And then Apple can say, well, look, you know, this app developer says they got the rights from there. Don't sue me. You know, don't sue Apple, Disney. You know, sue either the movie database or this Casey List character. You know, sue them. Maybe this is just a circumstantial. I think it was John that said that earlier. Hi, this is Casey. And maybe this doesn't have anything to do with it. But enough people have said similar things that it makes me think that might be factual.
These all sound like good hacks for trying to get through those first reviewers that you got who just aren't paying enough attention to your app, and you just need to find some way to find some words that their eyes are going to fall across and go, oh, that makes me feel better about it. Because again, Richard didn't say you need to add this statement. Richard didn't say you need to get this agreement. He didn't say anything. He said, you're good to go. Because he, I think, by the time he called you on the phone, understood what your app was about. Yeah. You know, as mentioned extensively in the app, as Ibrahim said, maybe you should have mentioned it more extensively in your app. Maybe your launch screen should be like powered by TMDB API.
In any case. So what are the plans for launch? So as we record, what is it today? The 26th of July. As we record, I'm not quite ready to hit the go button, but I think the plan is, and this is just between us ATP listeners. I think the plan is, on Monday, the 7th of August, that is the intention. Monday, the 7th of August, the app will go live. My intention is in the next 24 to 48 hours, I am going to cut off the previous member-only perk of the test flight. I honestly don't know if that will kill test flight access for all of you or if that will trickle away over the next 2 to 3 months, because I think the builds last like 90 days or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Maybe Marco, if you have tips on the most effective way to immediately kill that, let me know. But one way or another,
I think you can kill existing installations. You can kill new installations from happening, but you can't like remotely turn off everyone's installation.
Well, I wonder what I could do is expire all the old builds, with which there's literally 100 of them. But I don't know. We can talk about that another time. But one way or another, it's not the end of the earth if all the test flight people don't immediately subscribe. But it would make me very happy if you did. And I can tell you for sure that we will be removing the test flight link from the ATP website in the next 24 to 48 hours. I will be turning off the link on my end, such that even if you still have the link, it's not going to work anymore. And I will be, if I'm honest, I will be at least making an attempt at cutting off the test flight for ATP members. But all that being said, hand to God, this app is much better because of all of the people that used it before it went to app review. And I'm really appreciative of all the people that signed up to try it, that signed up at atp.fm/join. I'm appreciative of all of you who have sent me feedback. Almost all of it was extremely useful and extremely actionable. Some of it was not, but you know, that's how it goes. It's been surprisingly pleasurable for me to get all of this feedback and to work through problems that I didn't see because I'm too close to it. And if I'm completely honest, the reason I did all this originally was because I was trying to juice ATP memberships. but it actually ended up working out really nice for me in the sense that it worked out nicely for call sheet. So I'm really thankful for it. And I appreciate if you spent any time looking at the app and sending feedback and so on. But yeah, on Monday, August 7th, that is the plan, is I plan to release then probably 9 a.m. Eastern, but we'll talk about it when we get closer, or maybe I'll certainly be tooting about it on Mastodon. Maybe I'll be threading it. We'll talk about that potentially in a minute.
There are no precise app release times in the App Store.
Well, there's that too. That's true. But the idea is on Monday the 7th, and I'm really, really excited. I'm really scared, but I'm really excited. I hope the damn thing works, and I'm really looking forward to it. So on Monday the 7th, that's what's going to happen.
No, it works, and it's going to be great. You'll see.
I appreciate it. All right, continuing on the follow-up that will not end, and that's in no small part my fault. Hi, this is Casey. On Upgrade 468, an anonymous Apple engineer talked to the wrong podcast about Mac Pro stuff. What the hell is this?
I know, right?
I have endured hours of Mac Pro bullshit. I mean, content. I have endured hours of it. And the hell with you two. I don't get the benefit of getting this feedback to lord over these two jerks. I quit. Everyone's fired. You're all fired, and I quit. Anyway, Upgrade 468, which other than this moment is one of my favorite podcasts, but except right now, I hate it right now. But anyway, Upgrade 468, an anonymous Apple engineer working on the GPU team said the following. I presume this was John that transcribed this. Thank you, John. The Apple engineer said, the quad chip has been canned with no plans to return. For context, we are actively developing what will presumably be the M5 chip. And the quad chip was only ever spec'd for the M1 and removed late in the project. There are no plans to create a quad chip through at least the M7 generation. My understanding is that the quad required too much effort for too small a market. Something interesting that may come in the M8 and future generations is called multi-die packaging. This allows the CPU and GPU parts of the chip to be fabricated on different dies and packaged together, much like how two Max chips make an Ultra. With this design, it's conceivable that we could have 3, 4, or 5 or more GPU dies with 1 or 2 CPUs for a graphics powerhouse, or vice versa for a CPU workstation that doesn't need as much GPU grunt. However, as far as I know, no such plans exist yet. John, you have the floor.
So some of this is old information. We knew the quad was canned. We knew it was only planned for the M1, so on and so forth. But the new information is, oh, and by the way, we talked in a past episode, so they could do the quad in the M3 or generation or something. It's like, no, this rumor. And again, I want to emphasize that Upgrade cannot and does not vouch for this anonymous thing, because we get anonymous feedback. They just, you know, this is what they say. This is what they're claiming. So just, I don't want to, if this turns out not to be true, don't blame Upgrade. And don't blame us. It's, you know, you just sometimes you get anonymous feedback. But this is what this thing, this person claims. They said, not only is the quad not coming anytime soon, there are zero plans for it up through the M7. This, by the way, shows you how long the timelines are in hardware. Stuff has to be planned out years and years in advance for this stuff. Plans can, of course, change. But this really shows what Apple is thinking, if this rumor is true. About the directions. It's not like, oh, we couldn't do the quad, it was too expensive, and you know, the M2 is not that different from the M1, but we'll revisit this later. It's more like, we couldn't do the quad, it's too expensive, and by the way, forget about the quad. Just forget about it. We're just going to plan out our chips. We're going to go M3, M4, M5, M6, M7. We'll just plan out our long 5-year, 6-year, 10-year plan. Don't even worry about the quad. It doesn't need to be anywhere on there. We don't need it. The multi-chip packaging thing, we've talked about that back in the day when we were originally talking about the, you know, Jade 4C and everything, and chiplet architectures and the city of chips and different ways to put multiple dies in the same package. This is before we knew about the Ultra, really. But yes, of course, that is a conceivable approach. But if this rumor is true, if this anonymous, you know, inside tip is true, it tells you what Apple thinks of the future of the Mac line. And what it thinks is that it does not need to have anything more powerful than the Ultra. Obviously, you know, the M3 will be, when the M3 Ultra will be more powerful than the M2 Ultra, and up to the M4, M5, you know, they'll get faster over time. But it seems like they think that class of chip is all they're going to need. What that says about the Mac Pro, whether they keep shipping that big tower case or whether they don't or whatever, is not that important unless you're one of those people who really needs those PCI slots. But what this really says to me is they think that if you're doing something with a Mac right now where you have to wait for the computer, they're not going to do anything to help you other than give you one that is incrementally faster than you have now, right? Like, there's not they could get more performance. Like, there is more performance to be had, right? So in any realm, right, GPU or CPU, you could get a PC that has more GPU cores, much bigger, more CPU cores, much bigger GPU. They would do your task faster, assuming it's a cross-platform app or there's some equivalent or whatever, right? But they're like, no, if you get a Studio or a Mac Pro, which is basically the same, whatever speed that does it at, I know you could get a PC that does the task twice as fast because it has twice as many cores, but we're never going to sell a machine that's like that. So if you sort of look at the PC market and you say, here is the sort of performance ceiling for CPU and GPU for personal computers within some reasonable price ceiling, Apple is always going to be a fairly significant step below that because they're just not going to build anything that can compete with the high end, because they're saying we're not going to build something that's like a quad, and which means they're going to build the biggest thing they're going to build is an Ultra. And we kind of know the thermal envelope of the Ultra, the machine they put it in, you know, like, this rumor is saying is basically is like, look, if we can't fit it in the Mac Studio case, we're not going to make it. Because, you know, if we needed something bigger, it would, you know, like, I really don't think they're going to make an Ultra that's too big to fit in the Mac Studio case, for example, right? The M6 Ultra will fit in the Mac Studio case because that's what that chip is designed for. But you could build something with more cores that would be faster that would fit in the Mac Pro case. And this rumor is saying Apple does not plan to do that at all. And that's fine for people who don't really wait for their computers to do much of anything. But if you're currently waiting on your computer and you're like, boy, I wish this could be faster. Yeah, next year it will be faster. But if you're like, but this could be twice as fast if I had twice as many CPU cores, Apple's like, it could be, but we're not going to make that machine for you. And that may be fine because, you know, most people don't need that. But it is disappointing on multiple levels. Obviously, it's disappointing to me. And like, I think they should make that machine because it's an exciting thing to pursue and so on and so forth. But it does mean that a certain section of the market that continues to think, well, maybe next year they'll make one, and maybe this Mac Pro is just an interim step. If this rumor turns out to be true, those people who don't listen to this podcast probably are going to be like, as the years pass, they're going to be like, huh, I guess Apple's just not going to do that anymore, and they'll be disappointed. And I do wonder if we're not just going through this cycle again that we've gone through a couple of times, where Apple sort of loses interest in the Mac Pro level hardware and either stops making it or makes some that's disappointing, and then pro users get angry, and then Apple apologizes and tries to make a new one. Like, that's not a healthy cycle. But I mean, the two alternatives are we're in that cycle again, and we're gonna, like, there's gonna be some equivalent of the round table like 5 years from now, right, where there'll be some crisis and people are going to be complaining, or there won't be that crisis and Apple is just stepping back from that market entirely. And I think stepping back from that market entirely is, again, I think it's a bad idea, but it's also like, and not for the reasons you think, like setting aside GPUs, because I want to set that aside for a second, just CPU. The Mac Studio is small, and there's only so much CPU heat generation you can put in that case. Again, setting aside GPU, pretend the GPU is like as small as you could possibly make it. You can make and use more CPU cores for things that are highly parallel. Maybe Apple doesn't care about those things, like, you know, 3D rendering in Blender or whatever tasks that you have that can actually spread across all the CPU cores. Even something simple as compiling. If you have a huge application, I imagine if Xcode is doing its job, it could use 24, 48 cores if you're building some gigantic thing, maybe. I don't know what the best examples of multi-CPU things are, but those applications exist. And Apple is basically saying, even though you could use more CPU cores, we're not going to sell them to you. Oh, you know, and you can get them from Intel, because Intel will sell you something with 56 cores right now. And you need a big case for it. And we do have a big case, but we're not going to put any CPUs like that in there. And that's always going to be disappointing and limiting. The GPUs, now getting to them, this is actually a separate issue, because Apple could at any point in the future say, oh, and by the way, we've decided to bring back external GPU support, whether it's an Apple GPU or a third party. Like, that option is always there, even if it's just for compute or whatever. They can always do that. But the CPU thing is actually worse, because you can't add more CPU cores with a card, right? So as long as Apple continues to make a thing with card slots, at the M5 generation, if people are complaining or they think there's some market they need to go after, they can come back with the FPGA card, like the Afterburner, right? But they can also say, hey, we have an external GPU or some machine learning thing. Like, those slots exist. Apple can use them. There's nothing about the lack of a quad that precludes that. What the lack of the quad kills is big multi-core CPUs. because where are the CPU cores going to come from? Now, the whole idea of like being able to rebalance them, like let's make one with lots of CPUs and few GPUs or vice versa, that's cool and all. But if you have to fit it within the Mac Studio like thermal envelope, there's only so much horse trading you can do there. Like, oh, I want to have, you know, five more CPU cores, but then I have to reduce my GPU. And like, you can never put it as much GPU as you want in there because there's just not enough, you know, thermal headroom. And if you start pushing out the GPU for more CPU cores, you can't push out all the GPU. You have to drive the display somehow. So I think that's interesting. And I think if they actually use that technology, they should use it to make essentially the equivalent of the quad. That's not actually a quad. It would be an ultra, but there would be two much bigger ultras with different ratios of stuff, and then like a third-party GPU or something like that. So anyway, we'll see how this goes. Like, I don't know how much credence to put in this rumor. It is pretty definitive saying that we're just not going to do this for a long, long time. But boy, if there's not, because there was pushback before, like why did they have the Mac Roundtable? The Mac Pro was a big part of that. But part of what people wanted was make me a fast computer and make it expandable and quote unquote modular. Remember the big discussion we have? What the heck do they mean by modular? Well, I think what I thought they meant by modular, I said it as a joke, but also kind of serious, was they mean the monitor is not part of the computer. That's one definition of modular. And Apple makes a modular computer, multiple modular computers, where the monitor is not part of it. One of them is called the Mac Studio. That does fulfill one of the things that roundtable was about, because people were kind of pissed. They're like, I don't want an iMac Pro is an amazing computer, but what if I don't want the screen connected to the computer part? Please make me a modular computer. And they did, right? I mean, they made the trash can, and that was modular too, but that was also a problem. Right? That was before that. But the Mac Studio does fulfill a lot of that promise. But I do wonder if we're not just headed for another collision of people saying, come on, Apple, insert competitor name here, offers me an 87 core, you know, CPU, and NVIDIA is making this monster GPU that you can't compete with, but you offer me nothing that can do anything like that, and I have to leave your ecosystem and use PC instead because you don't compete in that category anymore. Maybe Apple will say, fine, see ya, I don't care, we don't sell that many of those anyway. But I do think that is probably a mistake. Like I said, the Vision Pro uses a chip from a Mac, granted a lower power chip from a Mac, but it does not use an iPhone chip. So I really do think Apple should reconsider these plans. It doesn't mean they need to make a quad, because maybe that's the wrong approach to making a Mac Pro caliber system on a chip or whatever. Maybe trying to put four of them together is too much. Maybe they want to revisit and say, we're going to make the Ultra, and the Extreme will be basically two things that are bigger than a Mac shoved together like the Ultra. You know what I mean? Right. There are other potential options, but that's not mentioned in these plans either. But I'm just the idea guy, Apple. You gotta run with this. My idea is don't do this, because totally giving up the high end is something that Apple has pretty much never done. In every generation of Mac they've ever made, they've at least sort of kind of tried to be in the conversation on the day of release with their high end computers to say, whatever the biggest, baddest PC can do, we can do some handpicked set of things better. And I think it's going to be harder and harder to be able to say that if they just say, we are never going to make anything that can't fit in the studio case. So this is a disappointing rumor, and Apple should see me after class.
Everything you can do, I can do better. No, it was surprising even to me. And as much as I like to give you two a hard time about the Mac Pro, I mean, I do want the Mac Pro to exist. I think there's something to be said for Apple having a no holds barred, just all out incredible computer. And I will sit here and debate with you, John, whether or not you need that computer. But nevertheless, I do think it should exist. And it is a bummer that they seem to be letting it go.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see how they market. Like, you know how they market? They're always like, oh, they have some graphs they showed against like old Intel Macs and stuff like that. But even in the current graphs that they put against like, you know, PC GPUs are mostly fantasy, but they're just going to have to stop doing that entirely, because they're just going to be like, no, we're never going to compete with that. But how can we? Like, how can you compete on a embarrassingly parallel CPU problem when you have half the number of CPU cores? Like, no TSMC, fab advantage is going to let you compete with twice the number of CPU cores or more on a highly parallel thing. And the same thing with GPU. So it's very disappointing.
Yeah, but I still, the more I think about this, the more I think that my passing theory from last episode about, like, this is really just, you know, the Mac Studio is the Mac Pro. And what we now know is the Mac Pro is just the Mac Studio in a PCI case. The more I think about it, the more I am comfortable with that theory. That
I mean, that is what they've shipped, but it's also saying that like they're not going to make what was previous. The Mac Pro is a slot in the lineup, and what you're saying is that slot doesn't exist anymore. Instead, there's a Mac Studio and Mac Studio with a backpack.
Sort of, except I would characterize it differently. That is like those are the facts, but I would say that's actually not only unsurprising, but mostly fine in the sense that when you look at where high-end computing is these days, Apple doesn't have much of a role in it anymore because Apple doesn't get along well with NVIDIA and hasn't for a long time. And when you look at what kind of roles do the Mac Studio and the Mac Pro not serve very well, most of that market is in the high-end GPU market. That's the biggest area where they're really underserving, I think. And I don't think Apple has been a major player in high-end GPU computing for some time now.
Yeah, so this like, might it's just a self-fulfilling prophecy. They keep making worse and worse machines and shooing the market, then of course they're not going to be a player. And then we've talked about this before, then you use the fact that you're not a player to say, well, we don't need to be in that market because we're not really a player there anyway. Like, you can get out of any market by slowly doing that to yourself.
That's true, and that is what they've done. However, I don't think this Mac Pro losing its GPU support is as big of a change as we initially thought, simply because that market has already largely left them. And again, through their own doing, you're right, but that market was already mostly gone. So I think having the Mac Pro exist as basically the PCI Express breakout box for the Mac Studio, and having the Mac Studio really be the current Mac Pro for most other needs, I think not only is that clearly the case, but I think that's fine. I think, again, it's not fine for everyone, but that is fine for most of the market that the Mac Pro still had at all.
Well, that's why I mentioned at the beginning, like, do you in your work ever have to wait for the computer? Right. Because some people, that's not true. Like, you just don't, people just don't have to wait for the, and I'm not talking about like network, like this web page is loading slow. Like, are you waiting for the local computer to grind through something using disk IO, using CPU, or using GPU? And like 99% of Apple's customers, especially in Apple Silicon, that is not, they don't wait for anything. Like, they're waiting for the network, but they're not waiting for, oh, the CPU is grinding over this or the GPU. Maybe game playing, you could say, I wish I had higher frame rates, but like, you're playing the game, it's fine. Right. But there are some people who are waiting for the computer, and for them to be out there knowing that this thing that takes them 15 minutes could take them 7 right now, not next year on a computer, but right now it could take them 7 because they could have doubled the CPU cores and their thing is using all the CPU cores. And knowing that Apple, like, quote unquote, could make that machine and Intel does, but they're not going to ship it to them, is going to be frustrating to those people. So we're going to be losing a new section of people, not the GPU people who already left, right? And not the people who, you know, wanted the stuff that Apple hasn't offered in years and years, but the people who pretty much up to this point expected that Apple would be in contention with, you know, again, with CPU power mostly, and occasionally with GPU power, to do whatever it is that they wait on their computer doing. Now, a big part of that is video stuff, where I feel like Apple still is in contention because they do have those dedicated units inside the SoCs for doing video. So I think the video people should be mostly happy, because I don't think a lot of those cases adding more of those video units would be useful to them, because they're usually just like trying to encode one or maybe two videos at the same time, but not like 20 of them at once. But I do think there's another class of people who wait for their computer to finish stuff, who are now going to know that they could be waiting half as long because their thing is parallelizable. And that hasn't been the case before. I try to think back, like, was there a time when Apple was just opted out completely? There have been dark times where they've done a poor job, but never has there been a time where they say, we're not even going to try to compete. And to be clear, this rumor doesn't really say that, because we don't know what the M6 looks like. You're just assuming it's going to have the same ratio of CPU, GPU power units, and efficiency cores as they currently do. We have no idea, right? So I don't, you know, even if this isn't true, you may be reading too much into it to think they're not going to compete at all. But it sure seems like that they subscribe to the idea that, yeah, you wait a little bit, but look, what are you going to do? Switch to PC? Probably not. So it'll be fine.
All right, Matt Rigby writes, this is in response to Marco's passing reference to having trouble with writing or mounting external drives on USB. In our somewhat extensive testing and troubleshooting at work, Apple Silicon Macs seem to have trouble with external USB mounted SSDs that are larger than 2 terabytes. Specifically, we encountered these issues using docks that include the Asmodai ASM235 USB to SATA chipset. This unfortunately includes the very popular OWC drive dock and other iterations of the Blackmagic rack mount SATA dock, among others. We haven't found any immediate solutions to this issue thus far, but we've had success with a variety of Nintendo-level plasticky docks from StarTech that don't utilize this chipset. So in short, Marco, you're not alone. There's definitely some chipset, driver, or Apple Silicon weirdness out there. Sorry, I don't have a solution.
Yeah, my solution has just been try to rely less on USB connected drives that are always connected. So that's why I moved my Time Machine to Synology. That was the big one. There's something weird with Apple Silicon Macs and many USB drive enclosure type things or SSDs. And I gave up. Like, I'm like, I can't keep dealing with this. So just move that role to the network.
I mean, you should check to see if you have this chipset thing. And because like a lot of those enclosures are fairly cheap, like you can get an enclosure of like $20 or $30, you might want to just try a couple of different enclosures and see if it solves the problem.
The problem is it's intermittent. So like it might take me months of troubleshooting to slowly figure that out. And it's not worth the hassle.
Indeed. Wall Street Journal writes that Threads is already losing its allure for users adding urgency for new features. This was, I think, a couple of days ago now. But anyway, for a second week in a row, the number of daily active users declined on Threads, falling to 13 million, down about 70% from a July 7 peak, according to estimates from market intelligence firm Sensor Tower. The average time users spend on the iOS and Android apps has also decreased to 4 minutes from 19 minutes. The average time spent for Android users in the U.S. dropped to 5 minutes from a peak of 21 minutes on launch day, according to SimilarWeb, a digital data and analytics company. Meta executives have said that they expected an eventual decline after the app gained more than 100 million signups within a week of its launching earlier this month. They have signaled that they don't see the fall off as worrisome and have said that they are working on additional features. Meta aims to increase the number of users and improve the experience before trying to monetize the platform.
I like that last sentence because it's like, oh, don't worry, we're adding features. So come back. They're going to be really cool. And then we're going to crap it all up.
Yep.
Before trying to monetize. So come back so we can put ads in your timeline. One of the most fun things, I think I mentioned this when Threads first came out, I said I was annoyed they didn't have a chronological timeline, but it's obvious why they needed an algorithmic one, because that's the right choice for most users. And the developers of the application said, oh, don't worry, chronological timeline is coming. And I said, but will I have to, re-enable it every single time I launch the app like I have to in Instagram? And they didn't answer. Well, guess what the answer was? The answer was yes. You will have to re-enable it every time you launch the app, because why would we remember that setting? Like, we want you to see the algorithmic timeline. And yeah, it'll stay on the chronological one. But if the app gets pushed out of memory or you relaunch it or 24 hours pass or whatever we decide, guess what? You're back on the algorithmic timeline. Just manually select the chronological timeline every time. I don't see what the problem is. Well, the problem is that shows that you hate me. So I don't like this app. But yeah, so this is why one of the reasons I'm very glad that we picked the title from Marco's phrase, 100 million tire kickers, because they got all users real fast. But you have to do something to keep those users. And despite what the Wall Street Journal says, and it's typical sort of, financial business person thing, they need to add features. I'm not sure adding features, lack of features is why people are leaving Threads. Like, they came in to kick the tires. And I think what makes people stay is a compelling experience, as they say in business speak. And that has very little to do with the feature set. People, went to Twitter and continue to go to Twitter, building their user base up to whatever it currently is, several hundred million or whatever they're down to now. But anyway, because of the experience on Twitter, and Twitter had like no features for a really long time. And granted, the bar has been raised, but like, it's not the lack of features that's making people leave. They're leaving, one, because I feel like it's a fragmented market, and two, they were just hopping in to check it out, and they're not entirely sure if it's a place where that they're going to make a home or whatever. They're not sure how it fits into their life, and they're not sure they, are really enjoying it, or there's something there that's making it sticky for them. And I think that has nothing to do with lack of features, lack of chronological timeline, lack of editing, any of that stuff. Like, because lack of editing, for example, didn't stop Twitter from being Twitter at its peak, had no editing. And that, we complained about it, but it didn't stop Twitter from becoming super important. So, I kind of agree with the Meta executives are saying, like, yeah, we knew it would drop and it's fine. Like, they can, you know, what they want to do is build it back up. There's going to be a big burst of interest and then people are going to taper off. But it's not like they dropped to zero. And the advantage Facebook / Meta has is they have the money and time and maybe the will to keep doing this and build it up. Like, it's not going to go, you know, the expectation that it would just say, and soon it will be 5 billion people. That's unrealistic, right? But they have time to make a go of it. So I don't think this is a doom and gloom story, but it does show how, you know, what those tire kickers thought. Most of the tire kickers were not particularly convinced by the experience of using Threads, which mostly has to do with what was it like? Like, what's there? What are you reading? Are your friends there? Is there interesting news there? Are you seeing celebrities? Like, do you find the content compelling? Kind of like the same way that what made people stay on Netflix is not the quality of the application or the video player, right? It was, do you like the shows? That's what would make people stay on Threads or any sort of social media type service. And then once you all get there, then your thing will be filled with ads. So, before trying to monetize the platform, before really making it just a miserable place to be.
And so I would like to do a temperature check for the three of us. Hi, this is Casey. What is your Threads usage these days? Because this happened for me and for John, at least. It happened before vacation, and I was looking at it, you know, like once or twice a day before vacation, and then vacation happened, and I don't think I've opened it since. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with Threads. I'm not saying that it's turned bad or anything like that, but I just kind of forgot about it. So I'm curious, and perhaps we'll start with my concurrent vacationer, John. Are you using Threads at all? Are you up, down, or about the same from a couple of weeks ago?
I still try to visit all the apps pretty regularly. Obviously, Mastodon is my main one. I have seen, like, so when Threads came out, I saw a big decline in activity among the people that I follow on Blue Sky. All those qualifiers are important, right? Mm-hmm. Because my experience is not the same as other people's experience, especially since I tend towards chronological timelines and not algorithmic ones. Threads, where I previously didn't even have a choice of a chronological timeline, I saw the Threads activity drop off after the initial burst as well. And most of the activity I see in Threads has nothing to do with anybody I follow because it's an algorithmic timeline and they're just throwing me random stuff in my face. And I think their algorithmic timeline does an okay job. Like, it wasn't totally off the wall of things I might be interested in, right? It was a reasonable mix of sort of mass market media stuff plus like people that I could conceivably be interested in following or whatever. I will try the chronological timeline if I can remember to reselect it every freaking time I launch the app because they hate their users. And we'll see if that changes thing. But I definitely saw less activity, like less posts from the people I follow, even given the algorithm, less replies, less mentions, less long conversations, right? Just, and I feel like that's natural after the initial burst of activity. But the Mastodon experience, like the Mastodon had a big burst of activity and it kind of tapered down, but the level it tapered down to, my timeline on Mastodon is more active and more interesting and more engaging to me than my timeline on any other service. But that's just me. I feel like that is not necessarily true for other people. I've heard from a lot of people that they feel like Blue Sky is that for them, that Blue Sky is where the interesting conversations are happening. And even though there was a traffic decline when Threads came out, still they feel like Blue Sky is like their anchor of where like the most interesting things are. And I bet that's true of some people in Threads too. So I don't know how this is going to shake out yet. I feel like Threads did get an important head start on being a mainstream thing. And certainly they still have way more than Mastodon and way more than Blue Sky, which is still invite only. But I still feel like it's anybody's game. And obviously I'm rooting for Mastodon to be like the slow and steady wins the race. Just, you know, no one can stop us because it's open source software and anybody can run a thing or whatever. But on that front, Threads continues to claim that they're going to federate with ActivityPub. So if and when something happens in that area, I'm sure we'll talk about it.
Indeed. Marco, what are you doing with Threads?
This is Marco. Marco colon. So far, I am mostly forgetting to open the app because I've just been working a lot on my Mac, which is what I am usually doing most of the time in my adult life. And there is no Mac story yet. And when I think the most likely Mac story that they add is not going to be some nice app like Ivory. It's going to be a web version of the phone.
Yeah, they said that's coming.
Right, which is, I mean, Instagram has that. It's not great. And so, and even the phone app is clunky because, like, there's not multiple account support. So, you know, if I want to have, you know, I have, like, my personal account, and then I have an account for Overcast, and we have an account for ATP. Well, on the Mac, I have Ivory always in four column view. I have my personal timeline, then I have my personal mentions, then I have ATP mentions, and then I have Overcast mentions. So I'm keeping track of my personal account and my two like work accounts all the time, and I'm able to quickly and easily post from each one, retweet from one to the other, or whatever the case may be. That's how I used Twitter for a decade or whatever, and this is how I now use Mastodon. And so while Threads has way more people, and in fact many of the people on Threads, as I mentioned before, the community I have found on Mastodon is wonderful for iOS developers and nerds like us. It is not wonderful for diversity at all. And there's a lot of people who I would love to follow their content, and Mastodon is feeling increasingly more strongly like I'm using desktop Linux. It's like there's only this one subset of nerds that I'm finding here. And again, this is probably mostly on me in the sense that it's hard to find people outside of your circles on the servers because it is less algorithmic. And that's I'm sure that's a lot of my fault. But it feels like this is a chat room for developers and nerds. And that's fine, but there's also other people in my life I want to hear from and read their stuff and interact with them. And way more people of way more variety that I want to follow are posting on Threads. And I'm not there most of the time because I'm not browsing it on my phone most of the time. I'm at my Mac. That's where I consume things. And I also don't find the Threads app particularly, you know, a good fit for me necessarily in the way it works and how it's organized, things like that. So I think the way I get to Threads is probably going to end up being via Federation if that ever happens. And as we discussed, that's not likely to be a great experience from either direction. So I don't know how that's going to work out. The way it's probably going to work is Threads is going to be very much like Instagram for me. Instagram is an app that I can't use on my Mac. And well, I guess I could use a web interface, but it sucks. So it's an app I don't use on my Mac because there's no third party clients for it. It can't fit into my workflow very well. I have multiple accounts, but I barely use them, and it's very hard to manage. And that's an app that has a ton of people who I'd like to follow, but I usually forget to check it, and I end up checking Instagram maybe once every week or two, and there's a whole pile waiting for me when I get there. I dip in, check a little bit. And then I, you know, switch apps at some point, and then I forget about it for the next 2 weeks. That's probably how Threads is going to go for me personally for the foreseeable future, because Threads is not where I am. It is on my phone. Great. I'll check it sometime, but it's not on my Mac.
Yep, I totally agree with you. And I do look at Instagram probably more than I should, but I certainly don't look at it near as much as I look at Mastodon now or Twitter in the past. And in no small part, that's because most of the day I'm at my computer and I want to use a native app to look at these things. And there isn't one for Instagram. There isn't one for Threads, and there is one for Mastodon, and it's great. So
yeah, the fragmentation is a problem for like the, you know, we're all looking for a quote unquote, Twitter replacement or whatever. Like Twitter had everybody. Twitter had the celebrities, Twitter had the tech nerds, Twitter had, you know, because it was the only thing. They got critical mass and there was no real competing services. Now there's just, there's even celebrity fragmentation. Like, so Mastodon has the nerd adjacent celebrities, right? So like a sci-fi author, like a famous sci-fi author is going to be on Mastodon, right? But like Tom Cruise is not going to be on Mastodon, right? Julie Roberts, whatever, who I respect, random movie stars. Like the big stars who are not nerd adjacent in any way, not on Mastodon right now. Threads has a bunch of celebrities, but those nerd celebrities who are on Mastodon primarily use Mastodon, even if they're also on Threads. So if they're having an interesting conversation, it's probably going to happen on Mastodon, but only because they're nerd adjacent. But then they miss out on conversing with the rock and roll stars who are on Threads or on Instagram or are still on Twitter. And so even the mainstream is fragmented. Like obviously the nerds are fragmented. Like it makes lots of historical sense why all the nerds are on Mastodon and everything like that. And I am glad that I have a nerd community there. But I do miss the feeling like, okay, but either two things, either the mainstream is at the same place where I am, which is not currently the case, or at least I know where to go to find the mainstream. And I feel like when I go on Threads, I'm not even getting all the mainstream because I see the people who are still on Twitter and I see the people who are primarily on Mastodon, even though they're technically on Threads. And this I think is related to why people might have checked out Threads and not be that interested, because they see the mainstream fragmentation too. They're like, oh, this isn't as hopping as Twitter was, right? Like, maybe if they find their little subset, like a lot of people have found like a good like niche community on Blue Sky, but you know, Blue Sky doesn't have all the mainstream celebrity, important, famous people, politicians, companies. Like, no one service has that anymore. And I think that, like, oh, if you go here, Delta Airlines is here, and that funny Comcast account, and your favorite celebrity, and your favorite sports star. There is no one place where all of them are. And having them all in one place makes that really compelling to the common person. And so now I can feel for someone who's like, no, I tried it, but none of these places are like Twitter used to be. And Twitter is also not like it used to be. So I guess I'll go look at TikTok, right? And that's where we are right now.
Yeah. And I don't see that being resolved anytime soon. I think we're going to be in this weird fragmented world for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that as well. All right, Marco, do you want to talk to us about the Ubiquiti Dream Router and why it's a piece of garbage?
Yeah, so I mentioned the end of last show. This is Marco. I mentioned that we purchased a new house and that I'll be setting up networking gear and stuff in it. And I was looking at Ubiquiti's new gear, and I mentioned in passing I ordered the Dream Router, and I couldn't believe it was only $200, and it seemed like the successor to the Dream Machine, which was their previous cylinder, which I'm literally talking to you through right now, indirectly. But anyway, many people wrote in to point out that the Dream Router, while it looks just like the previous cylindrical Dream Machine, is actually like a cut-down model. That's why it's so inexpensive, and in particular, it is apparently very slow to process things, and that its slow processor limits its throughput on an internet connection to roughly 700 megabits. And I mentioned I'm getting gigabit fiber. So everyone wrote in to tell me I should not use the Dream Router. It is too slow, and my gigabit fiber will oversaturate it, and I won't be able to get my full connection speed and whatever else. So first of all, thank you, everyone, for telling me that. I didn't know any of that. Second of all, this is great to know, and I will try to return it, although their website is currently broken for returns tonight, so I'll figure that out some other time. The problem is, I love Ubiquiti stuff, but the problem is, it goes out of stock constantly from their website, because everyone loves Ubiquiti stuff. So, the thing I was looking at instead of the Dream Router is the Dream Machine Special Edition. This is a 1U rack mount version of it. It has a few changes, but that's the one I actually was thinking about getting. And it's $500. It includes a PoE switch, like the Dream Router. Doesn't have an AP, but I get separate APs usually, so less important. Has a hard drive bay in case I want to use security cameras. I'll get to that in a little bit. But I was looking at the Dream Machine Special Edition as the alternative here, and the problem is that when everyone wrote in to tell me, when I was looking, it was in stock. And then when everyone wrote in to tell me I shouldn't get the Dream Router, I thought, oh, great, I'll just go order the other one I was looking at. And it's out of stock. Sold out. And it's remained sold out for the entire like week and a half since we last recorded. And also during that time, the Dream Router itself went out of stock.
Cool.
I believe it came back in stock today if anybody wants them. But this is the problem with buying Ubiquiti gear. They are frequently out of stock, just sold out, and you don't know when they're coming back in. You know, you can sign up for the notices, and they might come back in stock the next day, or the next month, or never. Like, you don't know. And there are, you can go on Amazon or eBay and pay some, you know, scalper vendor some premium over Ubiquiti's prices, which, and Ubiquiti stuff is usually pretty affordable. That's part of the reason they got so popular. So you can go pay, like, you know, Cisco level prices for Ubiquiti gear from some retailer somewhere who's ripping you off. But it's just, it's very frustrating when you need Ubiquiti gear now, and you go to get it and it's just sold out. But you know, that is, you know, ultimately that the reason they have this problem is that they are very desirable, and you know, they, you know, good for them. I've used their stuff for a while, and I think they've earned their success, and there's a reason why I keep buying their stuff. It's really good. But and it isn't perfect. Occasionally there's a dud, but you know, usually their track record is very high, and it's, and for what you're getting, it's usually pretty remarkably affordable. So anyway, all it is to say, don't buy the Dream Rider, turns out. I'm going to try to return mine and try to get myself a Dream Machine Special Edition if I can get it in time, but I probably can't, so I'm probably going to be sticking with the Dream Rider for a while.
Did you see their like Powerwall thing?
Yes, the Dream Wall. Called. That's $1,000.
It looked really cool, but it was very expensive.
Yes, the Dream Wall is basically like it's similar to the Dream Machine Special Edition, but it's this like wall hanging thing that it weighs like 25 pounds, hangs off your wall, and has a built in, I believe, an 18 port PoE switch. Has a massive PoE switch built in, and it's $1,000. It's like, okay, well, I see what this is for. I don't need 18 ports even in any switch for the new house. I think I'm gonna need something like, you know, 6 or 8 ports. I'm not doing like every room in the house, so I'm just doing kind of, you know, key areas that I learned are necessary, and that's about it. So anyway, the Dream Machine Special Edition will be fine if I can get a hold of one, and until then I'll use the Dream Router and cry.
All right. Hi, Future Marco. Do we want to do your CircleView HomeKit thing now, or do we want to let John do his rant?
No,
wait,
I don't want to push mine to next week.
Yeah, we either do
Marco's thing or SKTP, I think, right?
So either way, I can do my thing. My thing's not going to be long.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you really think you can get it done in 10 to 15 minutes, then let's do it. But
how much time do you want for after show?
I mean, honestly, those two things I have in the after show are so damn old, I can barely remember what I wanted to talk about. So if we can have a short after show, but I still think we should try to keep your circle view thing to like 10 to 20 minutes if we can.
Oh, yeah, I could easily keep. Yeah. Or should that be the after show?
I don't have a problem with that.
Is it an after showy topic? Like, I don't know. What are you going to?
Yeah, we'll figure out some other after show. I could make probably both of those items that I have in the after show right now super quick because I barely remember both of them. So why don't you do this? Just try to cap yourself to 10 or 20 minutes and then we'll see where we are.
All right. Cool.
Throwing to you? I'm sorry. We are professionals here.
Hi, this is Casey. I'm the host of the show.
Stop. Good grief. All right. So, Marco, you seem to be deep into home security or maybe home automation, or I'm not even sure what's going on, but you have some thoughts about Logitech CircleView cameras, HomeKit Secure Video, and more. What's going on?
Yes. So, as mentioned, I have cameras on the outside of my house for various reasons, and I've used various ones over the years. So, I have time-wise, my oldest cameras in use are an original pair of Nest outdoor cameras. These are probably something like 7 years old by now, and they're fine. And then I also have used the Logitech Circle View HomeKit Secure Video cameras for about maybe a year on those. And the Circle View, I kind of want to do the segment because HomeKit Secure Video was announced a few years ago or 2 years ago or something like that, and still to this day, there's only, as far as I can tell, two lines of cameras that work with HomeKit Secure Video. I think it's only the Logitech Circle View, and they have a doorbell version and the one I use, like the kind of standalone one. And there's there's a couple of Eve cameras, one indoor and one like hardwired outdoor one. And that's it, as far as I can find. There are no other HomeKit Secure Video capable cameras. And the appeal of HomeKit Secure Video is it sounds amazing on paper. And so I kind of wanted to give this like update 1 year in of having this be like my primary video system for this house, like, you know, how I've been using it and how it's been performing. So the Circle View cameras, they're relatively affordable. I think they're about $150, $160 each, something like that. They are outdoor or indoor capable. They have a 180-degree field of view, which is a blessing and a curse. It's hard to see detail very far away with that kind of perspective, but you know, you can put them pretty much anywhere and have a reasonably wide view of whatever you need to see. The selling points of HomeKit Secure Video are that, number one, you don't need to pay like an additional cloud service. Like most of these cameras, like Nest and everything else, like you usually have to pay some kind of cloud storage service fee, some new subscription every month. Oh, you got to pay $20 a month for Nest Protect Secure, you know, whatever, that kind of stuff. HomeKit Secure Video just uses your iCloud storage, and the number of cameras you can have on it is related to whatever tier of iCloud storage you have. I have the highest tier of iCloud storage, and I believe that entitles me to, quote, unlimited cameras, I think. Lower tiers, I think you get, like, you know, two or three or four or something like that. But HomeKit Secure Video is not continuous recording. It only records motion events. So if you want to look back and see, like, oh, you know, what were the leaves like, you know, 18 hours ago, unless there was a car driving by or a person walking by, you're not going to see that. It only records motion events and, like, the few seconds around them. So that's kind of how they get around not having too much data being recorded. By comparison, like my old Nest cams were continuous 24/7 with I think like a week or a month retention. The upside of that is you have a huge record of everything that happens around you. Downside of that is it uses a ton of data. Like the continuous streaming of that data to the cloud, to some data center in Google. Uses a ton of your ISP, you know, local bandwidth, so you need a pretty good connection. You need no data cap, really. But anyway, so that's kind of the main differences between those two systems. In terms of actually using HomeKit Secure Video stuff, the other advantage is that it does most or all of its processing locally. So any kind of, like, object recognition, any kind of intelligence, it's doing all that locally on your local network. It does require you to have some device being a HomeKit hub, like an Apple TV or a HomePod. But other than that, like that's the only kind of like downside requirement to it. But it does it locally. So the great thing about HomeKit Secure Video is that when things happen, they are fast. And this is one thing I absolutely love about it. When there's like, you know, we have like one on our, like the area where we park our bikes here. And every time someone comes home, they usually come home on a bike. And so I can always tell, like when Adam's coming home from school, I know because I get the tap tap on my watch and I look and it says bike camera. And I know, like, you know, 15 seconds later, he's going to walk up to the door and boom, there he is. And it's so perfectly reliable every single time. It is fast. And I know too, like when I go down there to get my bike or when I show up, I pull into the bike area and I feel the vibration on my wrist like 2 seconds later. it's that fast. It's awesome. What's also great about the HomeKit Video is that it is integrated with iOS very well. So when I get that tap tap on my wrist, I can look at my watch and right there on my watch, it'll show a little thumbnail. If I look at it on my phone and I long press notification, just right there in the long press view for notification, I get the video clip of the motion event right there. It plays right there. I don't even have to open any app or anything. So it's really nice in the Apple ecosystem to use HomeKit Secure Video when it works.
Oh, here we go.
So here's the downsides to this system. So first of all, the accuracy of the intelligence. Like, does it recognize things properly? Does it have false positives? Does it have false negatives? I have found the accuracy is usually pretty good. It usually identifies people, you know, when there actually are people there, although sometimes it thinks a moth flying around at night is a person. I don't know why. but for the most part, it's pretty good recognition. It is way better than my old Nest cams were. I don't have new Nest cams to test. I don't know how good the new ones are, but it's way better than the old ones are. Again, it's way faster to recognize than the old ones are, too. And I love those notifications with the video clips. That is great. The problem is the Logitech Circle View camera is really mediocre. It drops the connection all the time. It'll have long spans where it disconnects. And HomeKit helpfully alerts you when your camera disconnects and reconnects. So I see this happening all day long. I should point out, I have, I think, four of these in use on the network. So, like, the one in the bike area is super reliable, and all the other ones are not. And I don't know why. I don't really care why. They're not. And if you search the internet for, like, solutions on this problem, you see people all reporting the same thing, that their Logitech Circle View cameras are super unreliable and they drop off the network all the time, or they disconnect or whatever else. And everyone has solutions that basically amount to, like, turn it off and turn it on again, and it works for a while.
Oh, cool.
Like, if you reset the network in some way, like if you reset your router, it'll force them all to disconnect. When you turn it back on, they'll stay connected for a few days, and then they'll start flaking on and off again. People say, oh, assign a dynamic or a static IP, did that, no change. Put it on 2.4 gigahertz, did that, no change. Like, you know, all these different things you can do to try to debug a glitchy Wi-Fi device. I've done them all. I've had a year to do them all. The Logitech Circle View cameras are just super flaky, super mediocre. I will have spans of hours or days where a camera will just say no response. Like, so something could be happening. Like, somebody could be, you know, stealing my bike, and I might not know. And so I feel like it kind of defeats the purpose of cameras if a lot of the time when you go to look at them. So suppose we're away and a storm comes through. I want to know, like, what's going on around my house, and in, you know, maybe, you know, on my house, or usually if a storm's coming through, I'll put a camera in the house as well if we leave, so I can check and see, like, is there water coming in? You know, that's important stuff. And these cameras are just so unreliable, it's really hard to depend on them for anything. And I honestly, I'm torn here, because when it works, it's really nice. And I love all those integration features. I love how incredibly fast it is when it's working. But these cameras are garbage, and no one except Eve makes any other ones. And Eve only has one outdoor-capable one, and it requires it to be, like, hardwired by an electrician. You can't just, like, plug it into an outlet. It requires, like, direct wiring, and it has to mount onto a box. And I actually have one sitting here. I've had it for, like, 6 months, and I haven't had an electrician be able to come out and install it yet. So, like, it's just sitting here waiting. But it's like, that's not going to work for most of my use of these cameras. Like, you know, I already have four of the Logitech Circle Views. Like, obviously, I use a lot of these around, and anyway. So there's basically no options except the Logitech and this one Eve cam. Like, and this, I feel like this is a problem with so much HomeKit stuff. Like, it's a great system, but Apple doesn't make the equipment, and they outsource it to someone, and they make the equipment, and maybe it's okay, maybe it's not, maybe it's buggy, who knows? And that kind of defeats the purpose of the whole system, because, like, it undermines the quality of the whole ecosystem when we don't have good options. So anyway, all this is to number one, kind of warn everyone, I really don't recommend the Logitech Circle View, and therefore most of HomeKit Secure Video, because it is really flaky and really unreliable, and it's a shame. The other thing is, I'm curious if anyone has had experience with another system that's really good, that actually is reliable. I'm curious, like, is the modern Nest camera good? They've only seemingly updated it once since I've gotten the other ones, like, 7 years ago.
It's not Nest anymore. Like, so I have both of them. I have the old Nest, and I have a new post Nest, like, whatever it's called now, Google Home.
Yeah, the one
thing
that uses Google Home. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, my indoor one, so both of these don't have the speed thing that you're talking about. Like, they're network based, and they're not speedy too. They're pretty speedy with the hey, something has happened, but when you want to go look at it, it's really dependent on your network connection. Like, it's not, I don't think it's going to be as instant as you thought it would be. My outdoor one, I think I've had for about a year now. So far, so good. I mapped out its little area to ignore, like, passing cars, but tell me about, like, you know, things that are happening on my property with the little mappy, you know, those things they have where you just mask out areas. That's been pretty reliable. Also, its recognition, it has face recognition, so it can know who people are. And it also does, like, on its own, it can say vehicle, animal, person. All that is pretty much dead on. Like, when a rabbit goes by, it knows it's an animal. When a person walks by or walks up the driveway, they know it's a person. And when a vehicle pulls into the driveway, like, it's pretty good about that. But I feel like the interface to the data that it has collected is fairly impoverished. It is continuous recording, and I do have all this footage that I can go through, but the ability to navigate it isn't great. Like, I do wish it was, in some respects, I wish it was local, like you were saying. Like, well, not that iCloud is local or whatever, but processing local would be great, and storage local, like on Synology or QNAP or the other ones, would be great. But on the other hand, I love that everything is remote. so that if someone hits the camera with a baseball bat, I'll still have footage of them, right?
Yeah.
You know, or if, like, if the house burns down, I'll have footage before the house burns, whatever. It is nice that it's continuous recording to a cloud thing that, yes, I pay for, but the annual fee for me to have my two cameras is not too onerous, and it's basically 24/7 continuous recording inside and outside of my house, which I found very valuable, even just to see what the dog is up to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I can compare, because the indoor ones also have face recognition and supposedly know who everybody is. And it's pretty good. It tells me dog barking. Alex has entered the kitchen. You know, like, it knows people. It knows where they are. It knows what's going on when, you know, in the house when we're not home. But sometimes it's like unknown person in the living room. I'm like, oh, come on. It's just Alex again. It's the same person. Like, they're not unknown. And the indoor ones do that more than the outdoor ones do. So I think they have come a long way since. And I think my indoor one is even newer than yours. The outdoor one seems to do a pretty good job. And I like the strategy of the outdoor one to be a tiny standalone computer on its own. It makes them bulky and expensive, and you got to pay for the service. But I don't have a home hub to worry about. It doesn't interact with iCloud in any way. And I'm pretty sure I don't have an Apple Watch, but I see my wife, when she gets the alerts, she sees a little thumbnail of, like, you know, we noticed the person in your kitchen, and it shows them the person in the kitchen. Are they as timely as yours? Probably not, but they, you know, I think she can tap on it to see a little video clip too, if you know, if the cell data wins are right. So I don't think the modern Nest ones have all the advantages you just described. But in terms of reliability, I can pretty much always connect to the camera, and there has been no point where it has not been recording. Occasionally, if I can't connect to it, it's because my network connection is flaky wherever I am. But it's not like the camera didn't record that. When I get back home, I can use the awful interface to scroll back through to find that footage. So, I mean, this is not a satisfying answer. Yes, they've gotten better, but I mean, it's hard for me to recommend this over what you have, because it's just a different set of trade-offs.
Yeah, I just checked. So it turns out I actually have six of the Circle Views, not four, my mistake. So I have six Circle Views. Currently, two of them say no response. Earlier today, I checked, and four of them said no response, and they were a different set. Like, so it's just, they're unbearably unreliable. But, like, maybe I will try the Nest again. But anyway, I'm curious too, if the listeners know, like, I know Ubiquiti has their own cameras and they record locally, but you can access them remotely. And, you know, they record onto either one of their network video recorders or the hard drive slot in the router I'm trying to buy, but can't. I'm curious, like, if anybody has experience. I've never used Ubiquiti's cameras. I know Synology also has, like, a built-in surveillance station feature where you can have stuff recorded into that. I've never used that either.
So let me briefly interject here.
Yeah.
So I have never used surveillance station. I know almost nothing about it. It's the second thing on the list of to-dos after Call Sheet gets released. And the first thing is the fiber project that will probably never actually happen. But nevertheless, I do want to put a couple of cameras, like, around the house and perhaps one in the house to see what Penny is doing and when we're not here. But anyways, my parents have a Synology, a very, very small, like, I think it's two or four bay Synology. I think it's a two bay. And they use surveillance station, and I have seen it used a handful of times. I know very little about it, but my dad seems pretty satisfied with it. Now, I don't think he's very savvy, but I don't think he's, you know, to the level of any of the three of us. And I don't know what the notification situation's like. I do know that everything is recorded locally. I think it's processed locally as far as I'm aware. So I think it would get you pretty close to what you want. And I think the way it works is you get, like, one or two cameras per Synology, quote unquote, for free, but then you have to buy, like, licenses for additional cameras or something like that. Again, I'm talking very well out of turn at this point, but I believe that is a solution that you should at least investigate. It may not be the rightest answer for Marco, but I would at least take a look, because my parents have been using this for literally years and they seem really satisfied with it.
Yeah, like, I think ultimately what I'm hoping that the Ubiquiti ones are good, because most of them, maybe even all, but I think most of them at least, are powered via power over Ethernet. And I love PoE stuff.
That's what my parents is as well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. like, you know, first of all, it's way more reliable. because it hardwires the network connection as well. It also saves on cables. Like, then I don't have to have all these, like, you know, USB extension cables with sealed boxes to protect them from the weather running from these outlets that themselves have to be sealed. Like, it just makes everything better. And then it's easy, too. Like, then they have power backup because all my PoE hubs are tied into, like, my main UPS system, you know, backed up by Tesla Powerwall batteries. So, like, you know, I have, like, and solar powered, you know, in an emergency. So, like, any, like, all my networking gear I have, like, on redundant power, and so I can count on it even if, say, a hurricane comes through, I'm not here, and I want to see how my house is doing, I can probably do that, unless, like, you know, the fiber goes out. That's a different story, but, you know, for the most part, like, I love PoE stuff for lots of reasons, and that also allows me to then, you know, part of the problem with the Logitech Circle Views is that they, as mentioned last episode, they come with this roughly 10-foot USB power cable, and so, you know, you can only have it 10 feet from either an outdoor outlet or, you know, some kind of sealed box that you can put some kind of extension or surge strip or whatever into that can, you know, protect that joint from the weather, and that's annoying too, whereas I can just buy like a 100-foot Ethernet cable and just run it from the insulated inside through, you know, an outdoor pipe somewhere, you know, some exit out of my sealed area, and then run it to the camera, seal it at the camera end with, you know, an enclosure or some kind of goop or whatever, and be done. And that's it. And you know, so I think that's ultimately what I will probably try next. But I kind of just want to know, like, are Ubiquiti's cameras good? Is Ubiquiti's interface for accessing them good? Are the apps good? Are they reliable? You know, does it play well with iOS? Do I have to use one of those HomeKit bridging kind of apps, like either Homebridge or Hoobs or, you know, whatever? I've never used those before, but, you know, do I need to use those or can I get away without them? If I do use those, are those good? Are those reliable? Like, you know, it's such a big topic. And so anyway, I hope to get some good tips from people. So thank you in advance for whatever you can tell me.
Yeah, just very quickly with regard to Hoobs, Homebridge, and Home Assistant is the other one you'll hear a lot about. I did try to use Home Assistant literally years ago. It's unquestionably more powerful than Homebridge, without a doubt. It also was one of those things where the way it thought and operated was the antithesis of the way my brain thinks and operates. And I'm not saying it's bad by any means. And again, everyone who I know that can wrap their head around it, Merlin as an example, swears by it. But I just could not get my brain to click with Home Assistant. Homebridge is what I use, and it's extraordinarily reliable. I do almost nothing to it. I run it in a Docker container. I think we should probably start talking about those at some point, Mr. Marco. But anyways, I really do encourage and endorse Homebridge. It's very, very good, very pretty straightforward, pretty simple. It didn't used to be, but now it is. And I don't know barely anything about Hoobs other than I know that it's a thing that exists.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Indeed. You're welcome.
And yeah, and I should clarify too, like, the reason why I like having a bunch of cameras around my house, it's not just because I'm, you know, I'm not like paranoid about crime. You know, I have found many uses for these where it's useful to know. Like, for instance, if you're away for the weekend and someone drops a package on your porch, that's really good to know. So you can, like, ask a neighbor, hey, can you please bring it in or something? You know, like, there are lots of, you know, checking on your house during storms, checking on John's dog. Like, there's lots of occasions in real life where, like, oh, if you happen to have remotely accessible cameras in your house that are reasonably private, or not in your house, but like around your house, occasionally in your house. I don't put cameras in my house when I'm home. But, you know, if you're going to leave for the weekend, the storm coming, you put a camera in and you can check on stuff, like that kind of thing. I love having those abilities. They have proven useful many times. It isn't just to scare away people from peeing under my deck. It is also high utility. So anyway, thank you in advance for anything you can send me, listeners. And if you happen to recommend Ubiquiti stuff, hopefully it'll be in stock. So thank you very much to our sponsor this week, Notion. And thank you to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. And we will talk to you next week. That was Marco, by the way.
So over the last couple of weeks, I've had some interesting troubleshooting adventures, and I wanted to quickly detail them in part. So if there's anyone who ever runs into either of these situations, they can learn from my mistakes, and partly because I thought they were funny and or weird. First of all, when we were, where were we? We were gone for some reason. It was not the beach trip that just happened. It was a couple of weeks ago. I forget where we were, but we were away from home for a few days. I think we might've been at my parents', and a really bad storm came through Richmond, and it took out it. It's a long story why, which we can get into, but it's not interesting. But suffice to say, it took out the, it's not the ONT. It's like the power supply for the ONT. It's the thing that's in my garage, not the thing that the fiber comes into in the back of the house. It's the thing that's in my garage plugged into a regular outlet. And I believe, like I said, it's the fire, the power supply for the ONT, for the Fios. It took out that outlet. Like, that outlet is a GFCI outlet. It tripped for whatever reason. And so the Fios connection to the house was down for several hours. And a couple of days later, you know, after I'd come home and reset all that and so on and so forth, a couple of days later, I was somewhere, I forget where I was, maybe a library or something. And I was trying to use my WireGuard VPN. WireGuard is really, really good. And I like it a lot. It has a couple of features that keep me stuck to it. In the past, Tailscale has sponsored, and Tailscale, and they did pay us to say this a while ago, but legit, Tailscale is really good. And if it's a lot less fiddly than WireGuard. So I have Tailscale as like a redundant system in case WireGuard fails, which it was doing at this particular point in time. I couldn't figure out for the life of me what was going on. And I don't know if you happen to know anything about WireGuard, but do you know how WireGuard works, either of you, by chance?
Nope.
Okay. John, any notion as to how works? Okay. So apparently, and I am also getting outside of my comfort zone here, but apparently it all works via UDP. So what this seems to mean, from my limited understanding, is that the WireGuard client software will often tell you that you are connected when you are not, in fact, connected, because it's just sending, you know, packets out into the ether and assuming that they're getting to where they're supposed to be getting. It took a lot of troubleshooting for me to figure out what the issue was with my WireGuard, which would connect, but would do nothing. I couldn't reach the internet. Nothing was going on. It was dead in the water, except it said it was connected. As it turns out...
Was it IPv6?
No, very good guess. And you're kind of close. As it turns out, what had happened was I use a host name off of Casey, a host off of CaseyList.com as my house's IP address. And so, you know, I can go to, you know, mainstreet.caseylist.com, if you will, and I can get to that will, you know, will push me over to the house's IP address. Well, when the file is down for several hours, you know what changes? Your house's IP address. But because Tailscale is this, you know, weird UDP thing, or at least I think that's why, it thought it was connected. God knows where it was connected to. But when it actually tried to, you know, get any response from the WireGuard server, did I say Tailscale a minute ago? I meant WireGuard. I'm sorry. Anyways, when it tried to get to any information from the WireGuard server, it wasn't listening because it was at the wrong IP address. So it turns out fixing...
You said, like, you got a new IP address from Verizon is what you're
correct.
Saying.
Correct. Yes.
I mean, someone else probably has your old IP address. So
yeah, exactly. Exactly right. And so it took me forever to figure this out, including, you know, tearing down my whole WireGuard installation on my Raspberry Pi, which is the server, and rebuilding it from scratch, trying to figure out what the hell was going on. And it turns out I just never updated, you know, my mainstreet.caseylist.com IP address.
Why don't you have, that's what DNS is for. Why don't you have like a dynamic DNS thing for that?
Well, because this is all running through Hover, and I don't have anything that I've automated to like report into Hover that mainstreet.caseylist.com needs to be updated.
I've been using this free dynamic DNS thing for, I don't know, it's at this point, it's like a streak, like a contest. So that it's a free service that gives you a dynamic IP address. You pick the host name and they say, you know, you like something on your network will ping them occasionally and it'll let them know what your IP address is. Right. And it's free, but they really don't want it to be free. They want me to pay for whatever like the next upsell thing is.
Yes. I was using DYNDNS.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm using.
Which now is DYN.com. And mm-hmm. years ago, it became clear that they wanted nothing mm-hmm. to do with free users. And so I just abandoned it.
Right. Well, so I'm still using
Cloudflare, by the way. Like Cloudflare, they give a lot for free, like or for like, you know, Even their like $200 a month plan gives away a lot of like unlimited this, unlimited that, but they are always pushing very, very hard for the upsells, like for all the paid stuff that is not only not free and definitely not unlimited, it's extremely expensive and extremely, you know, you pay by the everything for the upsell stuff. And I worry, like, you know, Cloudflare right now, like a lot of things on the internet right now are only affordable to their owners and hosts because of Cloudflare. And I feel like they're one bad quarter away from ruining a lot for people.
I think they're doing okay. But like the free service that I used back in the, well, first it was just free back in the good old .com days. And then it was like, oh, they would send me an email every once in a while that said, like, visit this webpage to let us know you're still using it. So of course I just automated that and had a system that just, you know, and then eventually in the more modern age, they said, oh, well now there's a CAPTCHA on it. Right. At the point they added the CAPTCHA, I'm like, well, it's not worth my time to automate this anymore. So for the past, it's got to be a decade, I should look it up. For the past at least 5 years, maybe possibly 10, maybe more, once a month, I get an email that says, go to this webpage and click this I'm not a robot box or solve this CAPTCHA and to let us know that you're still using this IP address. And I've been doing it once a month for real. Oh, it's like a game of chicken. I'm like, I'll do this forever. Like Captain America, I can do this all day. I have paid $0 to this company ever, and I'm getting a free IP address that's always up to date with my IP of the thing, right? And they just constantly are saying, you sure you don't want to upgrade? Sure. I'm like, yeah, no, I'm sure. Yep, I'm human. No, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure this month too. I'll be sure next month too. And I just like, this has got to end. Like, I wonder if someone inside the company is like, this person has been on our free plan for 16 years. Can we do something about this? Like, no, I'm just going to keep solving the CAPTCHA. So, I mean, this is not probably a good use of my time, but like I said, I don't want to break the streak, but you could run DNS yourself, you know, run your own DNS. This is the old dream of the internet back in the old days. I'm going to run a Linux server. I'm going to have my own DNS and I'm going to run my own mail server. And that's so distant from us. But things like Fastly and Cloudflare actually do bring some of that back, or and AWS do bring some of that kind of back into reach in exchange for selling a small part of our soul to the man. But, you know, it is what it is.
Indeed. The other one, this story is going to have to be really quick and because I don't remember the details, but I was having a different networking issue inside the house. The call was coming inside the house for the second time I made that joke this episode. And I found that I think the Wi-Fi was working fine, if memory serves, but Ethernet wasn't working at all. And I could not for the life of me figure out why. I'm pretty sure that was a circumstance. And this started because I was downstairs trying out, I think, a dongle for my laptop before we went to the beach in case I, you know, but because I bring an Ethernet adapter everywhere because I'm a weirdo. And I just wanted to verify that this dongle that I had still worked. And it wasn't working. And I was like, well, that's weird. And then I tried a known good dongle, you know, USB-C to Ethernet dongle. That didn't work. Uh-oh, this ain't right. So then I move upstairs. I was doing this downstairs. And the situation downstairs is, you know, Ethernet to switch to MoCA bridge to coaxial cable that runs eventually up to the office to a different MoCA bridge to the main switch for the house. Total nightmare mess of, like, possibilities for issues. It's been pretty much rock solid for years. But if I'm in the troubleshooting mindset, it's a pile of what ifs that I needed to eliminate. So I come upstairs with the known good dongle. I plug it into my main switch. It's a 16 port, you know, gigabit switch in the house. I forget who makes it. I think it's D-Link. It's been, again, rock solid for years. And I plug it into the switch, still not working. And then I plug back into my desk setup with my beloved CalDigit TS4 that has Ethernet running into that, still not working. I think I rebooted my Eero once or twice trying to get that to work. That didn't work. Nothing is working. Would you care to guess, either of you, what the issue was and how I fixed it?
Is it IPv6?
Nope. Good guess, but no.
Is there a USB SSD you plugged into something?
No. No. You know what I had to do to fix it? I had to restart my switch, which is something I don't think I have ever said before in my life.
I've never had to do that. With right? Any switch
I was going to say you had to replace your switch. I don't think I know how to restart any of mine, but I have replaced a switch
yeah,
before.
I pulled the power from it, counted to five, put it back in. Everything's been fine since.
I think if we had like a power failure a couple of years ago, one of my switches was freaking out. The lights were all going crazy on it, and I yanked the plug on it. That helped.
Yep. So I did. Go ahead.
I did look this up. How long have I been freeloading on this dynamic IP? the answer based on the oldest email that I have telling me that I need to, you know, go somewhere to, like, your free DNS is going to expire unless you go to this thing and tell us you're still using it. The oldest one of those emails I have is from 17 years, 2 months and 21 days ago. That's how long I've been freeloading, once a month for 17 years.
Oh,
I feel like I'm really, really, you know, competing with Casey on the cheapskate scale here. Because it's free. Like, why would I pay for the thing? It does everything that I needed to do. The price I pay is and at this point, because of the captchas, like remember your IP and everything, I just have to click a link, click I'm not a robot, and I'm done.
So as I'm trying to generate links for the show notes, the link that I came up with when entering, I think, dyndns.com, which is what I remembered, is it pushes me to account.dyn.com, which I was like, okay, that's weird. That seems awfully specific. Wouldn't I want, you know, www.dyn.com or whatever? Do you want to try www.dyn.com and look at where it actually punts you to?
Is it a porn site?
No.
Somebody's like address?
No, like, it's somebody Oracle. Oracle.com. Apparently Oracle owns them now.
Nice.
So yeah, that definitely is not long for this world. Your freeloading is going to be taken.
No,
away
that's
real
not what
soon.
That's not coming. I'm using no IP. I've just looked it up.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
No-ip.org, but that just redirects to noip.com.
Oh yeah, I've seen those domains around.
17 years. They're still in business, and I'm still not giving them a penny. Sorry, yeah, this is an example of no IP. It probably costs you nothing to provide the service to me, but your free service, I will never not be satisfied with your free service unless you change something about it.
My goodness. All right, I think we're done.
All right. Titles, let's see.
My butler can't use it as good.
Oh, there were some good ones.
I do like suction per unit mass.
What was that about?
Dyson vacuum.
Oh, yes.
Let's see. This is still John's. Also good. Let's see.
Oh, did this kind of not get suggested? I thought I heard one. I'm like, oh, that's going to be a good title. And maybe just.
Yeah, I said title after something I had said that I thought
I
was funny.
Like, where are we now, Richard?
That is good.
Poor Richard. He did such a good job at his thing.
Did.
We used him as the butt of jokes on the episode.
That's right. What are you going to do?
We see you, Richard. You did a good job. We're just being snarky.
Yep.
Those other reviewers, not so good.
Not so good.
I like this is still John.
Did John remember. Actually say that?
I don't even remember. It just, it's.
I think I did say it. No, I'm all in on Richard.
I don't know if I want to call him out that much.
It's fine.
Yeah,
he just gave
I
his first
know.
Name. It's probably not his real first name anyway. Mm. You cannot record this. You cannot remember my name.
I do not.
If you talk about me, it has to be in a locked room that your family isn't allowed to enter
or hear you.
I don't know. I'm not absolutely vetoing Richard, but I have the same that Marco has. That shows that you hate me. That's negative,
I'm good with those top
funny.
Three: butler, still John, or suction per unit mass. I like all three of those.
I think I agree. Of them, I think I like this is still John the most.
I
but...
think you should get over your fear of Richard and just use the Richard one because it's the best title.
But you, how, okay, so the king has decided that a question mark is okay in the title, and suddenly it's all good.
The question marks are fine in titles.
No,
we've
used them before.
Have we?
Yeah.
Have we? I think my butler.
Because even though I used it as snarkily on the show, as a title, it just reads as like wondering how you're doing with app review.
I think I like. I stand by this is still John, but I feel like I'm the only one standing on that one. I think I like. Suction per unit mass as a turn of phrase, but as far as a descriptive title, I think my butler.
Yeah,
can't
we didn't
use
talk
it,
that much about vacuums. It was just a little pre-show right. thing.
Yeah, I think my butler can't use it is probably the best overall.
Yeah, I think butler's number one for me, still John number two for me, and suction mass number three.
Richard was clearly the best title.
Well, all the
if I had to pick among them, I would go with butler over suction.
All right, so butler is the winner. And all the bootleg people, you can tell John how right he was, as all of you flying monkeys always do. And you do not need to tell Marco and I that we were wrong. We'll just assume it.
You're just afraid of Richard. That's what it's about.
Yes, I am, because he was cool and nice, and I don't want to piss him off.
It was all in good fun. We didn't say anything mean about him. We reiterated that he was very nice and very helpful.
Nope, not doing it.
Yeah, it's best not to poke the app review beehive more than you have to.
Yeah.
All right.
Not a lot of show notes this episode. I don't feel like I fell down on my job, but I don't know. Not a lot there.
No, well, we mostly, you know, we actually talked about a fairly small number of unique topics.
Yeah.
All right.
You can link
to all that Ubiquity stuff if you have URLs for that.
I linked to the Dream Router, the Dream Wall, and the Dream Machine Special Edition.
I think that is most of what we talked about.
All right. Goodbye, live people. Yeah. We are live next this coming Sunday. Is that correct? I believe.
Yes. Yeah, Sunday night.
Sunday, and then I think that's the last of the weird schedule for the foreseeable future, as far as I know.
Yeah, because so we're recording on Sunday the 30th. We're not recording Wednesday the 2nd. And then after that, starting with Wednesday the 9th, I believe we're on a regular schedule for the foreseeable future.
Yep. All right, goodbye, live people.
Bye, live people. Thanks for listening. This was Marco, and we'll talk to you next. I'll talk to you on Sunday.
It's so close to this is Tim. Hi, this is Tim.
All right, goodbye.